shortly. Thank you. Welcome. We've just returned from a closed session, and I will ask our city attorney to report on that.
There is no reportable action.
Okay. We had a discussion with our city manager about management level issues and no action, no conclusions. Thank you. We will begin with a Pledge of Allegiance by Councilwoman Fonzie. Thank you. A roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Here.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Here.
Councilmember Kelly?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Here.
Mayor O'Malley?
Here.
All present.
Thank you. First item is the approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
We have a motion by Councilman Sturdivant, seconded by Mayor Pro Tem Moreno. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Our first item on the agenda is a presentation about a gateway to our city. We're going to turn it over to Jim Patterson and Linda Hindy. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley, council members, staff, and public members. I've had the pleasure of serving on the Carrizo Plain National Monument Advisory Committee for the past 10 years. And for those of you who may not know, the Carrizo Plain National Monument is approximately 50 miles east of Santa Margarita, just off Highway 58. It's approximately 250,000 acres, 10 miles wide, 45 miles long. It actually runs between Highway 58 and Highway 166 to the south. And it's managed cooperatively by the Bureau of Land Management, the Nature Conservancy, and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife. And it's one of the last vestiges of the greater San Joaquin Valley grassland. There's only about 6% of that habitat left in California, and the majority of it is in the Carrizo Plain. And it's the home of one of the largest concentrations of listed and endangered species in California. And those species include the San Joaquin kit fox, giant kangaroo rat, pronghorn antelope, tule elk, and a variety of other mammals, reptiles, and plants. It's a very unique environment. It has great archaeological, historical, and geological features. The San Andreas Fault runs along the eastern edge of the Carrizo Plain. Painted Rock is out there, and it's known for its paintings that were done centuries ago by the Chumash. It currently is still, for over 35 years, been an area where the Audubon Society does their Christmas bird count. It's a great refuge for migratory birds that overwinter in the plain. And that activity, that bird count, continues today. What we're here to talk about is the Gateway Program that Linda Hindy of the Chamber of Commerce is going to talk a little bit about. Most of the national monuments managed by the Bureau of Land Management are very remote, and they have a program that enlists communities nearby to help serve visitors and also provide information to visitors to those monuments. And just recently, the Atascadero Chamber became a gateway member. Santa Margarita, several years ago, is also a gateway community to the Carrizo, as is Taft. Activities on the monument include hiking, camping, horseback riding, botanizing, birding, and just about any outdoor activity you can imagine. Currently, there's a visitor center that is staffed by the Friends of the Carrizo Plain National Monument. It's open from December through May, closes during the summer when it's over 100 degrees out there. We don't get many visitors then. And the wildlife is typically hiding during the summer. But during those 6 months, or actually throughout the year, there's 40 to 50,000 visitors that visit the monument. And that surprises a lot of people because it is so remote. But quite a large number of people do visit that very unique place. And if you haven't been, any of you, I encourage you to go out there. The wildflowers, I'm told, even though they've just gotten a little bit of rain this year, are in bloom. So thank you, and I'll turn it over to Linda and Luke. You've got some pictures up there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Welcome, Ms. Hindy.
Thank you very much for having us tonight. We're very excited about this partnership through the Chamber of Commerce and the Visitor Center in our office. We're looking forward to partnering and providing educational materials for the visitors. And also, they'll be promoting Atascadero through their marketing efforts, letting interested visitors know about the gateway opportunities to get off of our highway here and go through Atascadero. What this means to Atascadero, which we're excited about, is it means that people are going to be stopping at the Chamber and getting the information, but also hopefully going into our local restaurants, stopping for gas. It's quite a little bit of a drive out there, so they need to make sure they're gas up or get a picnic. So the economic opportunity and through this partnership is just a natural fit for us. So we're very excited. We've already started the educational campaign through the Chamber, through our newsletter for the public. So we have a really nice article on that. And I think even myself, we're all becoming a little bit more aware of this beautiful monument that we have so close to us. So we're excited about the partnership, and we look forward to bringing more information to you and to the community. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, before you go, we've all received this nice visitor's guide. I assume
yes.
These are available somewhere for anyone in the public?
Yes. Actually, we've already had somebody read the article from the Tribune insert and bring that in, which was exciting. But we not only have the program that you see here that you were offered, but we also have different pamphlets on the Painted Rock and other different things to look at the monument site. So, and again, they have their visitor center open there, but we have a lot of their brochures and other information for the public, which will be great. And again, they're publicizing Atascadero for us as we are helping them out with their marketing and educational component.
Very good. Well, again, thank you, Mr. Patterson, for years of service on this project, and thank you, Linda Hindy, for working with the Chamber to have this be something our community can find out more information about by just checking in at the Chamber office. Thank you. Our next item on the agenda is the consent calendar. It's made up of items considered to be not controversial and may be able to be voted on all at once. We do give an opportunity, if any member of the council would like to pull an item or the public, for further discussion before voting on them. Any member of the council?
Number six.
Number six. Okay, that's the marketing item. Any member of the public wishing to pull an item? Seeing none, we'll come back and first. Oh, did I? Yes, the T-bid item number six has been pulled for further discussion. It'll be discussed separately. Okay. With that, I would entertain a motion for consent calendar items 1 through 5.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Do we need a roll call on that one?
Only because of number 5, yes.
Okay. Sorry. Well, then we'll go ahead with a roll call on 1 through 5.
You threw me there for a second. Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes, except for number 3. I was not at that city council meeting.
Okay. Thank you. Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Tom, I think you were not at that meeting either, I think. Were you?
Yeah, on item 3, if you need to show that as an abstention, that is fine.
Okay.
And we'll take up item six. I will be stepping down as I am a participant in being a transient occupancy taxpayer with a business that I own. I won't participate in this item, so I will join the public, turn it over to Mayor Pro Tem Moreno to lead that item.
All right. Thank you.
Actually, I just have one question. When we heard this before, I think the total price was $111,000. And part of my main concern and a good part of the discussion that evening was the $36,000 administrative fee. And I noticed in this report it was never mentioned. And if you could just explain to me how that is being handled. And that's the only question I have regarding this.
Yes, the TBIB board decided that they'd like to hire Big Red Marketing for their administration and support and basically managing the advertising campaign and all of that. That is a separate contract. It is under the threshold to bring it to the council. So they're estimating that that'll be between $25,000 and $30,000 a year and will be done at an administrative level.
Fine, thank you. That's the only concern I have.
And okay.
Unless there's public comment.
Were there any other questions from council?
No.
Do we have public comment on the issue? Okay. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you for your time. This will just take a couple minutes. My name is Dina Alexander, and I'm the general manager of the Carlton Hotel. I've been a board member since the inception of the Atascadero Tourism Improvement District in 2013, and I have to say that we, as a board, have worked diligently to get this T-bid off the ground and moving forward. It has been a slow process, but we've all learned and gained knowledge from this experience. Tonight, we are asking the council's approval to hire Verdin Marketing to represent the T-Bid in its marketing efforts over the next year. Sorry, I'm reading this. I'm not used to speaking in public.
It's all right. No worries.
In order to increase lodging at all Atascadero hotels. I was on the panel during the initial presentations, and Verdin's was exciting, inspiring, and we truly believe they can deliver. We have been very impressed with their expertise, experience, professionalism, and most of all, creativity, and look forward to a very productive partnership. Thank you for this opportunity to speak for the T-Bid.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public wishing to speak? Seeing none, I will close public comment and bring it back to the council for a motion.
I'll make a motion. We approve item number six as presented.
Second.
We have a first by Councilmember Kelly, a second by Councilmember Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
4-0, motion passes.
Thank you. I guess I could have started updates from the city manager while you got settled. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mayor, Mayor Pro Tem, and City Council members. The first item you have before you tonight that I want to talk about is the Citizen Oversight Committee for the half-cent sales tax that will be going into effect on April 1st. We are now trying to fill that oversight committee. There are 9 members on the committee. 7 of the members will be appointed by community groups, and 2 of the members are appointed by the City Council. And right now we have some advertising and press releases out asking for members. On March 26th at 6 p.m. right here at City Hall, we'll be holding a meeting for community groups. At that meeting, the community group's representatives will be determining how they're going to appoint the community group appointees to the Citizens Oversight Board. So basically, we're going to get the reps together. They'll talk about what is the best method for appointing those if there are more than 7 people interested. We also have a call for applications out and are advertising to get people for those 2 at-large positions that the council will be appointing. Those applications are going to be due, I believe, April 2nd. We have information on our website. and it's available here at City Hall for people that are interested in being appointed as a council appointee. We also are in the middle, we've kicked off our sign campaign. This campaign's underway, and the press release about the launch of the program was sent out to media. Approximately 1,000 letters were mailed to all licensed businesses in the city last week, letting them know about the reduced fees, the expedited sign program, where we'll be reviewing their sign permits and getting back to them within 48 hours. We tell them a little bit about the sign companies that are on board and know the program and are able to help them. We've talked to them about the AUP process. Hey, if your sign idea doesn't fit within our current guideline, apply for an AUP. We'll bring it to the DRC, and if we think it's fitting in with the character of a Tascadero, we can get it approved even though it doesn't fit the current guidelines. So all of that is contained in the letter that was sent out. We're receiving quite a bit of response from both the business community as well as from members of the media. The Chamber will also help get the word out to local businesses, and they'll be holding a Tascadero Signage Improvement Symposium. It's going to be hosted by the Chamber and will be held here at City Hall on April 30th. So they're going to be helping businesses and talking with them about how to improve your appearance and how to improve your signage and what it is that we can all do together to make things work. The announcement has also been shared on City's website and Facebook pages, so please take a look at that. It's a great campaign, and we're putting a lot of effort into that. Pizza Hut grand opening. Pizza Hut opened their doors to the public on February 24th and held their grand opening celebration and ribbon-cutting event last Friday, March 6th. From all accounts, the grand opening was well-attended, and they're doing a brisk business. They're located in the Vaughn Shopping Center, and we're happy to have them here in Atascadero. And the CERT graduation. Usually the CERT class is limited to 40 spots, but due to the increasing popularity and demand, we ended up with a total of 43 students who graduated in this last session. Class members learned invaluable emergency action procedures and techniques, including how to control small fires with a fire extinguisher, how to shut off utilities, how to make sandbags and use them for flood control, how to perform medical triage, techniques on how to correctly and adequately treat a variety of emergency and medical issues, and a number of things. I know I went to the graduation ceremony this year. It's a half-day training and a graduation ceremony, and I was impressed. All 43 of them were out there in the rain, bagging sandbags as they had a fire hose squirting water down the thing, and they were bagging that. They were putting out fires, and the fire guys were tipping the propane can on a side, shooting fire up 10, 20 feet, and all of the pupils were hanging in there doing that. And the drama class did a fantastic job simulating injuries, really getting into it. I was impressed with the work that they did. It is an amazing program. It's well worth attending. And I think you hear that from the graduates. In fact, today we received a thank you poem from one of the graduates. It's about a page poem. It's to each of the council members, and so it's in your mailbox there, just talking about the CERT program and what they got out of it. So we congratulate all of the new CERT graduates and thank them for their dedication to being trained to better assist their neighbors and their community in the event of an emergency. So, great program. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any council questions? Thank you for that report. Next item on our agenda is the community forum. It's the opportunity for any of you to talk on any topic that's not on the agenda that's under our jurisdiction. So welcome. Please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you. My name's Mike Casey. I live here in town, and it's my privilege to represent the Ministerial Association. We meet every Wednesday at noon, a group of us, and we pray for the city. We pray for you, and we pray for you to have a lot of wisdom. We live in a beautiful area, and you all do a great job. But we know that you represent a lot of people that do a lot of work here. And so if you would like to join me in prayer, those of you who do, I'd like to pray for all of you now. Heavenly Father, we thank you for the place in which we live. We live in a beautiful country, but we live in a gorgeous place, and we thank you for that. And I thank you for the servants that are represented here, everyone from just the city council and all the people that they represent. Lord, they make this a beautiful place. They have hearts of servants. They want to serve the people here, just like we all do. And so thank you, Lord, for their hearts, and we ask that you would give them wisdom. And as the people here tonight share their hearts, we ask that you would give them the words to speak, that they would be heard by this council. And Lord, just along the way, we just want to say thank you to you for caring for us and for allowing us to be so privileged to live here. And again, thank you for all the people that these folks represent that serve us, whether it be police and firemen, as we've just seen, all the way down to those who care for our streets. We just praise you for this in Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for being here. And give our thanks to the whole Ministerial Association. Welcome, next speaker.
Good evening. Good evening, Mayor, City Council, members, staff, and visitors. I'm the one that wrote the poem. My husband was a fireman with Tom O'Malley's dad years ago, and so my heart's with the fire department here. And the drama club. Those guys were perfect. They were really good. We had excellent teachers, our instructors, to show you how excellent they are. I only missed three questions, so that shows the teachers were really good. And an interesting thing happened right at the beginning when we had our outdoor our tests outdoors to see that we knew everything. It started raining just as my group was doing the sandbags, and it quit raining when we were finished. And I thought that was God trying to make it look real to us. Okay, I just wrote a little thank you. Thank you for the city for sponsoring the CERT program, and thank you for the fire department for pulling it off. To be or not to be is the question of the day. You want me to be a certified student? You got to be kidding. I can't be. No way. But it's not just about me, as you pointed out so kindly. It's all about us helping our whole community. You firemen are our heroes, from the beginner up, clear up to chief. So sometimes when disaster strikes, you may need a little relief. So you tackled a huge undertaking and commenced to teach a class of many beginners, not even knowing that CERT means you must act fast. You taught us to have a buddy so we wouldn't work alone, and someday we may make a difference to a person in their home. Now our class with CERT is over. How we use it is up to us. But hopefully we'll join the team. Thank you for teaching first class. So to our fellow graduates, congratulations are in store. Maybe someday we'll meet again. It could even be next door. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you for your participation in CERT. Welcome.
Good evening, Mayor, City Council, City Staff, and members of the public. My name is Matt Miranda, representing the Tascadero Firefighters Association this evening, bringing you an announcement of our upcoming fourth annual Firehouse 5K. That's going to be on April 11th. All of you City Council members have participated in one capacity or another, and we thank you for that continued support. This year's event, if you're not familiar with it, starts and stops at Tascadero Fire Station 1. Takes off, runs through downtown, goes through Stadium Park, runs to the tip top of our wonderful Pine Mountain, and it feels so good to be reaching to the top, and comes all the way back, and you finish the course underneath our 30-foot American flag hanging from our ladder truck. It's a wonderful sight to see after all that hard work. Once you get back to the station, you get to enjoy all kinds of things. We have a band, which is Dixie Dominus. They come to us from San Francisco area. They're actually pretty awesome. They just got done with their New York tour. They will have a European tour coming up, so they're a pleasure to have at the event. We'll have a barbecue being cooked up by all of our firefighters. We couldn't figure out what would be the menu, so we figured out tri-tip sandwiches, and it's at 10 in the morning, so who doesn't love a tri-tip sandwich at 10 o'clock in the morning? But we'll have the barbecue going, we'll have all kinds of different race snacks, and then we'll also have our health fair, and that showcases a bunch of businesses from our community, health-related businesses or emergency response businesses that have some type of services towards our community. So there's plenty of things to do, plenty of things to see. We'll also have our kids' half-mile fun run, which is sponsored by 911 Supply House. And it's always great to see the little kiddos get out there and encourage them as they take off and sprint like they like they're on fire. For signups, you can visit our website, atascadero firefighters.org. Find us on Facebook or visit active.com. And all the proceeds go to Atascadero Firefighters Association, which we end up just turning the money back into the community. We do sponsorships for different sporting events. We do Relay for Life, Alicia Ann Rouge Byrne Foundation, turn a bunch into high school scholarships. So we're very big on turning that money right back in. And that's pretty much all I've got. I'll place some flyers in the back. You've also got our flyer on your little slideshow carousel for us. But look us up on TascadoroFirefighters.org for more information.
Thank you. Heather, are you going to run in that again this year?
I'm going to quote Bill White from last year when I asked Captain White, why aren't you running this? He's on the sidelines. And he said, oh, I learned my lesson last year. So I learned my lesson last year.
Very good. That's good. Some council members don't learn their lesson from last year, so you're way ahead. Welcome. Next speaker.
Keep learning from a next yes. teacher. Keep learning. I'm Marlene Lutz, and I'm the coordinator for the ladies' conference that we have here annually, first full weekend of March. And many of you are well aware of the ladies' conference as you participate with it and help us with it. We bring in at 400 to 500 women every year. Right here to Atascadero, and our goal is to bring encouragement, and we really do want to bring in quality, a quality program. We bring in people from all over the United States as speakers. Over these years, we've had some very, very profound speakers and musicians as well, and this year was no exception. So we're very pleased that it was a successful event, and we are so grateful to this city for everything that it has to offer. We were able to bring business into the community through the hotels and the food offerings and the gas stations and whatever else, and ladies like to shop, so it was successful in that way for the city. Want to thank our police department too, and our wonderful mayor for gathering together security for the event, especially in the evening when the ladies really feel more comfortable having a man walk them to their car. That was very, very nice. Mayor Pro Tem Moreno was an excellent MC, and so maybe some of the rest of you would like to participate on another year. We'd love to have you. It's an event that brings together people from all over the community. This year we also had people from New York, Indiana, Colorado, Nevada, Arizona, all the beach cities are well represented, as well as women here, right here in Atascadero. So I hope I've covered that well, but I just want to express our gratitude for the beautiful facilities that we have here and the choices we have, because we did outgrow the pavilion, and sure enough, we had another place available to us. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And that other place available was our community center just down on Traffic Way, which can accommodate up to 500 guests, and that is great. Well, you've done this just about 40 years now, I believe. This 33. Well, darn close. Thank you for your service in our community. Welcome. We have a trio.
Yes. Good evening. My name is Tony Lastra. This is April Rutherford and Jillian Sturdivant. We're members of the Atascadero High School Show Choir. We want to thank you so much again for letting us speak at your community forum. We're currently planning an exciting trip to New York City over spring break and would like to reach out to this community for help to get there.
We have spent the past several months fundraising and have approximately $6,000 yet to reach our goal. This trip is very important to us. It will be a once-in-a-lifetime dream trip, which will include a personal Broadway workshop with a musical director, a Broadway star, and choreographer. We will see several Broadway shows, and our sightseeing will include the Empire State Building, a tour of Juilliard, a ferry boat ride to view the Statue of Liberty, a visit to the 9/11 Memorial, Washington Square, Central Park, including museums, and much more.
It is easy to help. You just simply go to the website and type in gofundme.com/Broadway or bust. You'll see a cute picture of the entirety of the Atascadero High School Show Choir, and you simply click Donate Now and enter any amount that you wish to give.
Thank you so much for your support. We are taking A-Town to the Big Apple.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Very good. Welcome, next speaker.
Well, how do you follow that? I mean,
it's a tough act to follow. You'll have to sing at the end, you know.
Oh, gosh, that's scary. Thank you so much. Good evening. I'm Ashley Akers. I'm the Vice President of Client Services and a partner with Verdin Marketing. And I just wanted to say we are so excited for the opportunity to partner and work with the City of Atascadero. And Mary Verdin, unfortunately, couldn't be here tonight. She sends her best and would also like to thank you for this great opportunity. So we look forward to much success. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, once again, Linda Hendy, President of Atascadero Chamber of Commerce. A couple things. One, I'm very excited for the partnership with the city in the sign strategy cleanup here in our town. We just think it's very beneficial for the businesses to have that the lower fee. Just we're hoping that we have a lot of businesses take up that opportunity. And I know the staff here has worked very hard on the outreach that we're doing within the next few weeks. So we're excited for that, and we welcome any calls or any questions about that program. And the sign symposium, again, is on April 30th here, actually in this room. Second, what I wanted to mention to the business community is we've started a new program through the Business Walk, a follow-up for that. We're offering private business consulting classes, or actually consulting hours at the Chamber of Commerce 2 times a week, every other, the first and third Tuesday of the month. And that is for chamber members and non-member businesses. So we really, what we wanted to do is provide an opportunity for economic development for businesses looking to open a business, but need assistance in navigating through that. And then also, second, if a business is struggling or like to increase their business or has questions on structuring, we have also professional consultants with that as well. We're partnering with the Mission Community Services and the Women's Business Center in San Luis Obispo, and they have just a great opportunity of different professionals that will come and meet with the interested parties personally. So I welcome the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Now, we do want to make sure we are near the end of our public comment community forum portion. We've already dispensed with closed session and the consent calendar. So if there's any other person wishing to speak on any item, this is your time. And we'll welcome one time more around.
I forgot something important on the CERT program. And I know it took a lot of work for the fire department to make the barbecue for us. It was an excellent barbecue, and I know it took a lot of teamwork. And somebody even told me that the firemen paid for it themselves. So I don't know for sure, but that would be great, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other member of the public wishing to speak on any item? Seeing none, we're going to close public comment, bring it back to the council, and we'll go ahead with our other items on the agenda. The first is a public hearing on the 2015 CDBG Final Community Development Block Grant Funding. And I will begin with a staff report.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley. Good evening, City Council. Recommendation tonight on this item is for the City Council to review and approve the final funding for the Community Development Block Grant and authorize staff to make the adjustments to the final numbers, which I'll get into here in a second. The council did have a public hearing last fall that reviewed draft estimates of what this funding would be. This funding does come from HUD and is federal funding administered through the county. The HUD good news is the estimate is increased now $22,000 from December when the city council last saw this. So the total funding now is roughly $154,000. Some of the HUD requirements for this funding is that 15% of it is limited to public services. Back in December, the city council, maybe I'll just forward this here real quick. Oops. Here's a table with the original estimates from December in that first column and the final allocation in the second that staff is recommending. Since it went up, the public services portion also increased roughly $3,300, and staff is recommending that this additional funding be put into the ECHO column there. The City of Atascadero and the Loews and Fishes would remain the same. So anyways, when this is, if the City Council does concur with staff, the final recommendations will be sent to the county, and then we'll be able to implement the program. So with that, I can take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Councilman Sturdivant, followed by Councilman...
Let me get the button right.
We'll go with Councilman Sturdivant first.
In the staff report, it talked about Paso Robles possibly giving the additional funds to ECHO to go ahead and offset or increase our 7119 above the 8,000. Did that happen?
That did happen. Last Tuesday, the Paso Robles City Council authorized $28,720 to ECHO. So our additional monies will meet that minimum $8,000 threshold.
Thank you very much.
And then Councilwoman Fonzi.
Was wondering whether any other city had decided to donate to Loews and Fishes, or is this just Atascadero?
I believe since this is the only donation to the Atascadero Loews and Fishes, I'm not sure about other cities, districts with the Loews and Fishes, but I know this is the only one for this particular branch of Loews and Fishes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. No other council questions. This is something that the council was very much concerned about when we learned of a drastic reduction in this funding source some time ago, and we had a lot of discussion at this council and other councils. We have had discussions at the countywide mayor's meeting looking for ways to make sure we could meet this minimum amount and not exclude some very worthy organizations. So I think people did work very hard on this. It's very tough to have so little of funds to give to some of the most needy segments of our population and organizations that just do an extremely good job with the little money that they get. So it was a tough one for us. We're glad there was some more funds. With that, I'm going to open up to the public. You want to make a comment?
I would just like to thank Pastor Rubbles for the large amount of money that they gave to ECHO. I think this is the first time that another community has really helped ECHO like this. I know it's been in discussion with some of us over the year, but I think it's really an honorable deal that they did recognize what ECHO does, not just for Atascadero, but for the whole North County. So thank you, Pastor Rubbles, and thank you, ECHO, for what you do.
Yes, I did have a number of meetings with Mayor Martin and Pastor Rubbles and their council
has seen the value, and they hope to work with ECHO more and would like to see a parallel program get started up there, and I know you'd be a good resource for them. So we do compliment PASO and look to work with them more. And probably once again, the PASO mayor and the Tascadero mayor will spend a night at ECHO once again this year, I'm sure. We'll open it up to the public for anyone that would like to speak on this item.
Tim Eccles, I'm the grant officer for Tascadero Loaves and Fishes, and that, by the way, is the oldest serving nonprofit in this city. We also serve Templeton areas, California Valley, Santa Margarita, Creston, and our operating budget is right around $160,000 a year. The $8,000 allocated to Loaves and Fishes serves almost a month of operating expenses at our pantry. We combine that with the other grants that we receive. Approximately one-third of our operating budget is from corporate and government grants. The other two-thirds, I think the city should be proud to know, is really from private individual donations. And I would hope that the community, the culture, the demographics of this city will continue to support that for years to come. I am likely one of the youngest members, I believe one of the youngest members on the board. I see Mike and Charlotte Burns here. They've been contributing for many, many years. I've been a resident here in Atascadero since 1985, and it's a pleasure to have an opportunity to participate with such a wonderful nonprofit. I need to recruit and ask you to understand what we're going through also with our organization, which is as many as 160 volunteers to operate our pantry and serve on our board. We've recently lost a couple of significant members. A year and a half ago, we lost Pat Gipri, our noteworthy pantry manager. And then most recently, Frank Furtsnyder, who served in many organizations, but has been a longtime member of Atascadero Loaves and Fishes. And there are others that are more than I can mention at this point, because just since my participation, since 2012, we've lost really several members. We need volunteers, and we need a younger crop of volunteers to carry us forward. We've had some successes, and we'd like to continue those successes. And remember, we're serving a group of working poor. Only 5% are transient. 95% are either working in a low-wage job or are underemployed. 21% are veterans. 34% are children. And 30% are disabled. I thank you for your attention and your attention to the Tascadero Loaves and Fishes.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley, members of the council. My name is Jim Patterson. I'm the current president of the ECHO Board of Directors. And it's challenging in this community particularly. There are so many worthy programs that are staffed by volunteers meeting needs of the community, and it's challenging when there's such a limited supply of funding to go around. And I wanted to take this opportunity to thank the council for all levels of support that you've given ECHO over the years. We're especially appreciative of the council and city staff for the efforts over the past 2 years to meet the criteria to become the official emergency shelter for Atascadero. We especially appreciate the effort of Chief Haley, former Community Services Director Warren Price, and Alfredo Castillo, and other staff members, Rochelle Rickard and others, who have worked with us to meet the conditions of approval, which I'm pleased to say we've finally done. And through that process now, we've expanded and we've increased our bed count 67% from 30 to 50, serving up to 80 meals a day. And obviously our cost has increased significantly with those additional services. So again, we appreciate the allocations that you have made to ECHO, the support you've given us in kind, and we hope that that will continue. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome. Next speaker.
Hi, Mayor O'Malley, council members, staff. My name is Bill Watt. I'm the executive director of ECHO. I just wanted to comment. I think it's unique and very, very special that we had two jurisdictions come together, support homeless services on a regional basis, and I think it's a true model. You don't see it happening very often, but I think what it speaks to is just how everybody comes together for ECHO from so many different viewpoints, backgrounds, levels of experience. I just want to say that that partnership is what's going to allow us, I think, over the long haul, to come up with parallel services in Paso Robles, that working together. Because I could just see this council, when something gets going in Paso, supporting that. So I just want to thank you for that special effort, and also comment that it's nice to see a 15% increase from government funding from HUD, and it's also nice to see the final recommendation be significantly higher than the estimated. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Charlotte Byrne, and of course on the Loaves and Fishes and ECHO Board. And I want to thank you, as we all do, for your continued support. We see you there at ECHO a lot. And so we're growing, as Jim pointed out, in all ways. We're growing with more beds, more meals, more volunteers, more overnight volunteers, more landscaping. So a lot of the upgrading we've done has been very expensive. So everyone assumes that we're doing very well in all areas, and we are, except for maybe the finances are tight. So we thank you for increasing the amount tonight, and any other time that you find any little bit of extra money, you know where to spend it. We would appreciate it. And last Tuesday night in Paso Robles, the word that was used in regard to ECHO was spectacular. And then they took the vote. So that was very nice. And for years, they're trying to catch up to what we're doing here. And we're going to be encouraging them to have a shelter of their own someday. Paso Cares is a wonderful organization, so they're coming along, and we thank you for all the support that has always been here from Atascadero.
Thank you. Welcome.
I'm Mike Byrne, member of the board, Mayor O'Malley, members of the City Council and staff. I want to thank you very much. I recall that in 2001, you first began putting your faith in ECHO, and we really didn't have a permanent location then, but we did have the Baptist Church for part of the year. And you granted us a CDBG grant for $5,000, and that money was used to convert a utility closet into a shower that served the needs of 31 people in the shelter. That was our start with you, and your faith in us has grown, and we want to thank you for so many years of this wonderful support. Some significant things have really happened to put ECHO on the map, and you all have to take the credit for this, and that is that we do have an executive director who's pulled our organization together. We used to take pride in believing that we could get by as an all-volunteer organization. We fairly soon on became fairly realistic about that, and so in the last 3 years, we have hired an executive director who's made all the difference in so many ways. We have a social worker who, with the assistance of other agencies, can work with a family or an individual and during a 90-day period get them into housing. 70% of the folks that work in that 90-day time frame and follow the directions end up in housing. We have a volunteer coordinator who recruits and manages over 1,000 volunteers to leverage the money that, we receive from donations and from your generosity in the CDBG grants. So we thank you all for this and for the wonderful good that you're doing for the homeless and the hungry. And we look forward to continuing our relationship with you. Thank you all.
Thank you. Any other speakers on this item? Seeing none approach, I'll close public comment. And, of course, again, we've already been thankful for all of the organizations, especially ECHO and Loaves and Fishes that have been here tonight. But, you know, I think it would be fairly unanimous by the council to use the word spectacular for the Burnses all of these years. So I think we'll just give that as a last comment on that. Bring it back to council. Any further discussion or a motion?
Well, I would like to make the motion that we approve the funding recommendations for the 2015 Community Block Development Grant Program.
Second.
We have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Moreno, seconded by Councilman Fonzie. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Thank you. Moving on to management reports, we are very anxious to hear about the Zoo Master Plan Amendment and the Thelma Vetter Red Panda Exhibit. Another nice donation from our community. And I saw Mr. Baker somewhere. There he is.
We're going to turn it over to Alfredo to start, and Alan will jump in about halfway through, if that's all right, Mayor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley and fellow council members. Typically, community development talks about building permits and design, and instead today we'll talk about some pandas. So before you this evening is the Zoo Master Plan Amendment, the Thelma Vetter Red Panda Exhibit. So just a little bit of background on this. The City Council did approve the Zoo Master Plan in 2004, recently has undergone some facility upgrades, which includes a revamped zoo entry, zoo electrical upgrades, a new flamingo exhibit, new gift shop, food service area, Madagascar radiated tortoise exhibits in progress, as well as some major rehabilitation of the aviary, and the new toucan exhibit is also in progress. As a part of this, there was also additional many maintenance projects that were completed in the past year, including the repair of the lemur exhibit, installation of new fencing, removal of old stone beach, removal of new planters, installation of permanent electrical systems, installation of DV surface structures, installation of pond pumps, as well as repair and replacement of flooring on the turtle building. So a lot of work has been done at the zoo over the last year and over the last many years in terms of upgrading the facility and getting it to where it is today. Tonight we're going to talk about the late Thelma Vetter, who donated the funds for the design and construction of a new red panda exhibit. So this is the image of the current zoo master plan. So this is sort of the vision. It's very similar to our general plan. It's very similar to our downtown visioning plan, where not everything happens overnight. But instead, it does take time. As funds come in, we do things as they go along. So we are going to discuss the red panda and how it fits into the Indo-Burma hot zone. And Alan will discuss that in a bit. So the red circle there is the location of the existing panda exhibit. So it's this circle right there, and they will be moving. That is an image of the current red panda exhibit as shown today. So this is the proposed location of the proposed master plan amendment of where the red pandas will be moving. So they're currently over in this location, and they'll be flipping back over to this new location, which is currently shown as the picnic area, birthday party puppet show area, as well as using some of the old boneyard area to do this new exhibit. So the need for the red panda exhibit is we are needed to keep the pandas here. We need a new exhibit to keep them on a permanent basis. One of the other ones is providing additional enhancement of the zoo consistent with the council goals to transform the lake park into an event center. So you made that into a goal back in 2013 through 2015 and reaffirmed those goals recently. So this is a part of meeting, this is a task that meets that goal and vision that the council has established. And again, this furthers the goals and visions that were established by the zoo master plan that was adopted back in 2004. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alan, who's going to walk you through what our proposed vision for the new Red Panda Master or exhibit will look like.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and City Council members.
New exhibit is something we've been waiting for at the zoo for a long time. It's a chance for us to really build a new exhibit that actually meets all the current requirements and ideas that a major modern zoological facility would have. It's a little bit of a change from our older exhibits where they're very static. You kind of walk up and look at the animals sitting behind a cage. This is a totally different experience. The exhibit's designed as multi-species. There'll be more species than just red pandas in that exhibit. And the people will actually almost go on an adventure. We refer to these type of exhibits as exhibits that take people on a journey. And so what we hope is when people enter this exhibit, they'll feel like they're heading right into a section of Indo-Burma. All the plantings, all the cultural items, all the graphics, everything we talk about in there will represent this part of the world to help us educate and explain how important these things are to everybody. If you look at the picture of the red panda exhibit, it kind of has two methods to get up. It has a stairway leading to the first platform and also a ramp that's ADA accessible to get people up there. What we wanted to do is, since the zoo's 5 acres, that's very limited space-wise, but when we go up and down and change people's height and things like that, it really changed the perspective of the zoo and it changes the feel of how big the zoo is. If you look at the drawing there, because we wanted you to be able to see what the exhibit looked like, a lot of the plantings aren't really included in there. When you actually see the exhibit and walk in there, you'll be walking into a bamboo forest. You won't be able to see the people on the other part of the exhibit. You won't be able to see people walking on the other parts of the ramp. You'll really feel like you're in a forest. When people get up to the first viewing area, they're about 4.5 feet off the ground. They'll be able to see the pandas, and then a ramp goes up to a higher exhibit, which is about 8 feet off the ground. So it's really a different perspective of how people can see the pandas. And the unique thing about it is there won't be any caging or anything like that, and the appearance will be that the pandas are essentially just sitting there on a tree about 5 feet from you, and there's nothing keeping them in. That won't be true. We will indeed be very secure and make sure the pandas can't get out, but it'll be more of an illusion. But really, to take a photograph or to see the pandas, you won't have that wire mesh or the cage bar-like things, you know, destroying your vision. We also realize that we don't utilize the zoo as much as we possibly could, particularly because for using evening events, because the zoo was really not designed to be open in the evening. So with this new exhibit, we've incorporated new lighting, new pathways, in an attempt to be able to like broaden our hours and get people in there and also help increase our revenue stream. This was designed with a little bit oversized viewing areas on purpose, so we could theoretically have a small group come in there and rent that out in the evening, come to the Panda Forest for a wine and cheese tasting event, something like that. City council members could go there and, you know, have a little meeting or something. So it's really going to be, we don't want to do that yet, I know. But it's going to give us an opportunity to kind of also hopefully change and create another new revenue stream for the zoo also. It's going to be named for Thelma Vetter, who is the lady who passed away, who the money came from. And we really wanted to make sure that we honored her and that people would be aware that this exhibit didn't just drop out of the sky, that there was a citizen of Atascadero who really sponsored this. So we're calling it the Thelma Vetter Red Panda Exhibit. And it'll have an entrance plaza that kind of mentions her name, and as you can see on the slide. So the other thing is once you're in the exhibit and you come back down from the walkways, you'll be able to walk around the outside of the exhibit, and there's a ground-level viewing area with glass panels that are raised a little bit off the ground. So that will allow children and people in wheelchairs or you know, other people like that that have another distinct view of the red pandas and the muntjac deer. And again, you'll be behind glass, so you'll be right up close to the animals. We tried that with our meerkat exhibit a few years ago, and it was super successful. The people love that. After about a month of figuring out the glass was there, the animals now do come right up to the glass. So essentially the people, it almost looks like you can touch them. There's just a little pane of glass between you and the animals. So we think that's going to be an added experience at the zoo.
Thank you, Alan. So as we've mentioned before, the trustee has donated funds for the initial design. So the Thelma Vetter, the state of the Thelma Vetter had initially donated funds to come up with this design scheme. At this point in time, what we're looking for is the council to bless this plan so that the estate can now execute a second portion, which is the construction documents to be completed, and then from there, construction. Now, those items would start after a memorandum of understanding or an MOU is entered in with the city through the city manager's office. The estate of Late Thelma Vedder will take responsibility for the construction of the exhibit, and it is anticipated it will begin sometime in late spring after the building permit's been reviewed by city staff. And staff is currently estimating that it'll take approximately 3 to 6 months to complete the project. So really careful attention will be made to selecting a contractor as well as, you know, letting them know the types of ins and outs it'll take to do construction at the zoo, particularly with the animals that are there. So safety is in mind, not only for the workers themselves, but our animals that we are enclosing currently at the zoo. So it will be a very interesting process, but we will work with the construction company that does the ultimate construction to ensure, again, the safety of the animals that are so precious there at the zoo itself. So just a little bit about Ms. Thelma Vedder. She was a resident of Atascadero since 1946, and she was very active in the Historical Society as well as the Friends of Atascadero Library. One of her big love affairs was loving of animals and caring for them. She, in her estate, she felt that she wanted to not be recognized for this generous donation. However, the estate feels otherwise, and as do we as city staff. So we are naming the exhibit after her for her generous donation and, again, for her love affair of these animals that are housed at the zoo. So the city staff is in support of naming this exhibit after the late Thelma Vedder, and, again, recognizing her for a generous donation as well as having the community recognize her passion and love affair for the animals that are at the Charles Paddock Zoo. So, in summary, the proposed Red Panda exhibit is generally consistent with the master plan that's part of your Resolution A. The exhibit will enhance the experience for zoo visitors. As Alan had mentioned, in looking at this from a design perspective, there are many viewpoints and vantage points that you can see. And really what we're creating is a very world-class zoo exhibit that you see at some other larger zoos, such as San Diego, San Francisco, even Santa Barbara. I had a chance to go to Santa Barbara a few weeks ago with my kids, and this is the type of facility that when my daughter, who looked at it on my desk, said, wow, this is awesome. Atascadero is getting something so awesome. This looks just like San Diego. I'm like, yeah, it is. So we're really creating that world-class experience, and this is the first step. Again, this really does meet the goals, intentions, and it's a revenue stream. I know, again, the APA, the American Planning Association, we hold a yearly conference. We had one in Santa Barbara a few years back. Our actual event, our showcase event, was at the Santa Barbara Zoo. It was an after-hours event where over 1,000 planners attended. A lot of revenue was generated and a lot of interest. And we actually had it at the zoo at the elephant exhibit. And it was really good to see the animals after hours being very active. So this is, again, a new source of revenue stream that we could use to really promote not only the zoo but the lake park as an event center. One of the big ones here is that no city funds for the design and construction of the exhibit is being done. All that is being funneled through the estate of the late Thelma Vedder. There will be a small fiscal impact, and that fiscal impact has been my time and Alan's time, as well as city staff time in terms of reviewing the building permit. So it's the only sort of staff funds that have been really expent on this one. But again, it's all hopefully going to a good cause. So the council does have alternatives tonight as a part of this presentation and management report. So the council may include any modifications to the project. Staff is not recommending anyone at this point, simply because we've worked really diligently with Alan. The architects worked with Alan and the zoo to really come up with a design that really meets the needs and the intentions of the zoo itself. City Council may determine that more information is needed and may refer the item back to staff to develop that additional information. We'll come back for you another night to discuss that additional information. We also recommend denial of the project, so the council must specify reasonings for denial and make associated findings as such. The Parks and Recreation Commission did hear this item a few weeks ago, back in February, and they are recommending that the council approve Draft Resolution A, the proposed amendment to the Charles Paddock Zoo master plan to allow for the construction of the new Red Panda exhibit. Second resolution does authorize council authorizing the city manager to enter a memorandum of understanding with the trustee of the estate of the late Thelma Vedder for the construction of the Thelma Vedder Red Panda exhibit. And with that, we will open it up to council questions.
Thank you. Well, I am darn certain we won't deny the project tonight.
And if you could maybe put the slide back up of Thelma Vetter to leave that up there too. Again, just another example of what makes Atascadero great. I think just about everything we've accomplished in our community has been with volunteer effort. So many examples, and this is just really special for our community. We've got a number of questions, and let's go ahead, and I'm going to follow lights, and you can share whatever you would like. We'll start with Councilwoman Fonzi, followed by Councilman Sturtevant.
Thank you. Good staff report. I'm very excited to see this going forward. I have a question for you, Alan. How are we going to involve the public to get them excited about the project, and how are we going to roll this out to the public?
Well, we're actually starting to think about that a little bit. We actually had some baby red pandas born at the zoo this year. That generated a lot of interest in red pandas. A lot of people weren't aware we had them at the zoo and stuff like that. So we're probably going to have a kickoff and informational campaign, try to get some of the media up here and talk about it. And we'll have some opportunities as the exhibit's being done to kind of feature progress reports and things like that, to keep people updated and kind of keep that excitement going and hopefully build. The other thing, too, is, as I mentioned, there'll be other species in there besides red pandas. So it gives us an opportunity to kind of showcase some of these new animals and talk about them and hopefully build the public excitement for what's coming at the zoo. And, of course, we will have signage there at the site, like, you know, what's coming and things like that. And, of course, really cute photos of our red pandas that are at the zoo right now.
Is it possible to have some kind of outreach to the schools? I think one of our best ambassadors for the zoo are actually the children in the zoos. I don't know how we could do this, but perhaps that's something that could be done.
Yeah, we can take a look at that. We also already do outreach with our education department out to the schools, and the schools come into the zoo. Unfortunately, the red pandas can't travel, so it makes it hard. You know, if you go talk about red pandas, they kind of want you to have one with you. But if they come to the zoo, it makes it real easy for us to take them over to the panda exhibit and talk about that. And, you know, we really have started to emphasize the hot spots and how the zoo is adapting and changing and letting people know for all the changes that are coming in the zoo now that this is just one part of a huge, big difference that they're going to see. We've already started moving some animals around and things like that. So we definitely will be looking to work with the schools and our children to make sure they're aware of that. They're really already excited about it, to tell you the truth.
Great. Thank you.
Well, normally we go through council questions first. I'm going to kind of have a little more leeway because I think everyone wants to comment on this. So feel free to share any thoughts without getting into deliberation or emotion, obviously. But if anything else, I'll just pretty much go through each council member. Okay, then Councilman Sturtevant is next.
Actually, just very quickly, I've actually been in an exhibit like this where it's multi-level. This is very exciting. Just when I saw this, it just really struck me as this is just very upscale and just a beautiful exhibit for our zoo. So very excited. A question I have is the construction process. How impactful is that going to be on attendance, on the zoo being open, people coming during that 3 to 6 month period?
We've had the last year to learn how to like get people in and out of the zoo while we're doing a lot of construction projects. So we think this will have minimal impact. The site where it's located is real easy for us to just seal off from the public. So, and we have the access through the boneyard so the construction crews can go in and out. They really shouldn't even have to utilize the public walkways at all during the construction of this. We think this is probably one of the easiest things we'll do because of the location. So we're not worried about that at all. That should be really straightforward.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilwoman Moreno, followed by Councilman Kelly.
A couple of questions. I'm wondering, the time frame is a 3 to 6 month on constructing. So if all goes according to plan, when would it start and then potentially open?
I guess I would defer that to the trustee. Mr. Glenn Lewis, okay. Who's a trustee for the state, okay. Is actually here in the audience, and he can speak to that better than I.
Okay.
Welcome, Mr. Lewis. No, we'll go ahead and handle that now.
Good evening.
Good evening.
My name is Glenn Lewis. I'm the trustee of Thelma's estate. She was a personal friend for like 35 years. And anyway, to answer your question, we have retained the architect, Era Studios in San Luis Obispo. Both Al and I interviewed several of them. We thought that they had the best presentation, and I think you can see here. They have a very nice original idea about what both Alan and I were trying to emphasize. According to Tom Jess, who was the owner and the person that we had dealt with, he thought it would take about 60 to 90 days before he would have plans that were at a point that we could actually put them out to bid for contractors. And so I'm going to be a little bit more pessimistic after talking to Tom Jess. I don't think this project will be done in 6 months. I don't think we'll be able to even start it for probably at least 3 months. And according to Mr. Jess, he thought it would take 6 months to build it. So I'm thinking probably more like 9 months to maybe as much as a year. It's going to be a first-class project. I'm not going to go El Cheapo on it. Al and I have talked where I don't want the city to have to spend money maintaining things. We're going to use products that are permanent, or at least as permanent as can be. So I'm going to try to make it not be an expensive situation for the city. It's built with the idea of, as Alfredo indicated, and I want to thank him, he did an excellent presentation tonight, but it's built towards connecting to other projects. So when you're at the top, the area that Alan was describing where is wide enough to have small parties in that, you're going to be able to continue off of that, go to another exhibit, so you won't have to come down all the way and go all the way around. You'll be able to go from one exhibit to another in a free flow pattern. So again, Alan and I, we've got 2 years of thinking of this project before we even arrived tonight. But again, I think you're looking at probably 9 months, maybe as much as a year before this project's actually going to be open for the public.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, it's sounding like maybe a holiday party at the zoo. I'm so touched, and it's similar to Bertha Schultz and what she did to our fire department and what the fire department and the community meant to her. And the same with Ms. Vetter. It just really is so touching. And so thank you. And thank you for obviously being a big part of this. I did have one other question, and this might be Rochelle. The funds, will they be paid directly from the trust, or does it go through the city and then get reimbursed by the trust? How will that work?
The trust will be building the exhibit directly.
Okay.
So Glenn Lewis will be hiring the architects, the construction firm overseeing that, and at the end of the project, they will donate the facility to the city. So that's how it will work.
Okay, thank you. And also, thank you for that attention to not needing ongoing, you know, maintenance and really taking care of that. So it's a quality exhibit, and bringing something like that to Atascadero. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. One of the main reasons why we are spending so much time and effort is my concern for this city. We need to make reasons for people to come here. I mean, it's a beautiful place to live, but unless you live here, why are you coming here? Okay, we have the zoo that is a wonderful little zoo, but you're not going to come to the zoo just to come to Tascadero. So hopefully this is something that's going to be the beginning of an expansion of a zoo that will be a purpose for someone to actually want to come to this town. And so Thelma loved this town just dearly, dearly. And we had many talks about what she wanted to use the funds for. And one of them was to improve the zoo so that it would be a stopping off point for those who did not live here in Atascadero. Yeah. So that's one of the main reasons why we have worked so closely with Alan.
Well, and judging by Alfredo's daughter's comment, I think we're on the right track. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilman Kelly.
I think the timing on this is really interesting, because I think about 3 or 4 years ago I contacted Glenn regarding the Vetter Trust Fund in regards to a donation for the Charles Paddock Zoo, and there was a significant donation made out of the trust at that time, although I did keep the confidentiality that you requested until now, but I would like to say that it was a nice contribution there. And at the same time, another check was issued that I brought over to the city in a large amount. So I think we were slowed down a little bit on the statue, but we're hoping to have an unveiling of the statue on the 4th of July at the Lake Park ceremonies, and I'll have an update on the statue a little later on. And by your scheduling, maybe we could have a groundbreaking at the same time on the July 4th. It seems the time frames are real close. So I would just like to thank you for, you know, fulfilling Mrs. Vetter's wishes to help our city and the zoo. It's much appreciated. Thank you.
You're welcome, Bob.
Thank you. We have no questions or further comments by the council. I'll open it up to the public. Anyone wishing to speak on this item? And thank you, Mr. Lewis, for sharing some of those answers. Seeing no one approach, we'll close the public comment, bring it back to council, and as maybe some of us lifetime residents, I'm going to go ahead and make the motion that we accept the Parks and Recreation Commission recommendation.
I'd be happy to second it.
We have a motion by Mayor O'Malley, seconded by Councilman Fonzie. Although we'll be able to do a roll call. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Excuse me. Councilmember Fonzie? Yes. Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
So I was right. We did not deny the project. We are very excited about this and are very thankful. Kind of chokes you up, doesn't it?
Yes.
We're going to move on to the next management report, the 2014 pavement assessment study. Not quite as exciting, but still very important.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley. Very exciting for us engineering types.
Yes.
The Pavement Engineering Incorporated was hired by the city last year to evaluate the condition of all the city streets. And then update the pavement management software system. This is a pretty big task to do and very detailed work, a lot of man hours into it. And I'm happy to report that we are complete with that process. PEI is here tonight. Joe Ryrie is here. Joe is very knowledgeable of pavement management and probably just as passionate, I guess, about it as well, as you'll see. One of the things we wanted to talk to the council about is with the 0.5% sales tax increase, we want to be very, very good stewards of this money and make sure that we spend it the smartest and get the most mileage, no pun intended, out of every cent. And to do that, we can utilize this pavement management software system. It is a scientific and economic planning and analysis tool that we can use. There are a number of other economical, safety, and social political considerations into this as well. But maybe if it's okay, Mayor O'Malley, if we can, I'll have Joe, if we can have Joe present and then maybe bring it back and council and can ask some questions, and then we can talk about maybe the next steps going ahead.
Very good. Go ahead. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Mayor, members of the City Council. It's exciting to be here. I happen to think that pavement is really one of those topics that keeps you up at night for good reasons. We think about it all the time. Pavement Engineering is a civil engineering firm that specializes in pavement. Our corporate office is located in San Luis Obispo, but we get the pleasure of being able to work with agencies throughout the state of California. Tonight, we get to present to you kind of the state of where Atascadero is at, and we're going to have certain presentation goals that we're going to try and accomplish this evening. We're going to review a little bit about pavement. We call it Pavement 101, just to make sure that we're all on the same page as we talk about what the next steps need to be. We're going to review the assessment findings, And then we also want to talk about recommendations for future strategies in terms of what can be done to improve the pavements of Atascadero. So let's start off with pavement 101. Did I just do something bad?
Well, it is black. That's
very good. Okay, so when we look at pavement, we look at two different parts of it. We want to look at what it's covering, what's under it, and then what's on top. That determines how thick the pavement structure needs to be. Pavement deteriorates not in a linear fashion, but it looks fine for a long time, and then it just kind of falls off. The graphs, there's three graphs there because sometimes additional traffic or poor construction can also cause a pavement to deteriorate quicker than it might have been designed to do. Pavement deteriorates two different ways, and we're talking about asphalt concrete pavement, which is predominantly what Atascadero has for its pavements. One way is it deteriorates is environmentally, by the oxidizing of the binder within the pavement structure. The other way that pavement deteriorates is by fatigue, loading conditions, the constant bending and flexing of the pavement until it breaks, similar to when we take a wire and we work it, and then it snaps in half. The same kind of fatigue cracking is happening with our pavements. So with the oxidizing effects of pavement or the environmental effects, we mentioned that it was water and also the sunlight that affects the pavement. Taking the pavement as a gathering of the aggregate held together by oil, and that oil begins to age harden and it begins to crack, and the oxidation from water and from the sun causes that to happen. And there are certain distresses that you can notice and observe to be able to tell whether or not a pavement is deteriorating environmentally or whether it's deteriorating by fatigue loading. We mentioned the other way that pavements deteriorate is fatigue. This sometimes is really hard for folks to wrap their head around, and so we developed a little bit of a graph to be able to help talk about the effects of heavy vehicles on pavements. We took a Chevy S10 Blazer, and for those who remember those, you know how old this was when we put this together, but it still stands perfectly fine in terms of its reasoning. We took a Chevy S10 Blazer to one of those weighing junctions on the freeway, and we weighed the axles. And then from that, we determined, okay, based on other types of vehicles, how can we equate something that people can relate to, a vehicle about the size of a S10 Blazer, to the impact that it's going to have loading-wise for different size heavy vehicles. And so a two-axle truck, you can see, is equal to 442 Chevy S10 Blazer units. And then you can work your way down and see the impacts of trucks or buses are almost 8,000. The impacts of a garbage truck are upwards of 9,000. And one fully loaded five-axle truck that you see delivering to Vaughn's is equal to almost 15,000 Chevy S10 Blazer units. When we design a pavement, remember we talk about what's on top and what's underneath? This is the what's on top part. And we want to know the impact of those heavy vehicles. And so we think of the pavement, the best way to think of it is like a bank account. And we design enough loading into the pavement so that every time a vehicle drives over it, it takes a withdrawal in that amount in terms of it's sucking the life out of the pavement. When the bank account hits zero, that's when you start seeing a lot of the fatigue cracking and the problems that you start to see with the loading conditions. So we were under contract to go out and rate your city. And we used a very common technique called a pavement condition index. We shorthand it and call it a PCI. And we use a scale from 100 to 0. 100 is a brand new pavement. 0 is a pavement that's at the end of its service life. To determine what a pavement index is, or a PCI, we go out and assess the different types of distresses that are on your road. And we go out and we take sample areas, and we then use the equations that were developed many years ago to be able to determine a pavement condition index. These are some of the common types of pavement distresses that you would be able to observe. All of them are present in Atascadero. The first on the left-hand side is a condition or a deterioration effect called weathering and raveling. When the pavement is first laid down, it's a matrix of all different size aggregates, and what happens is the water starts to run over the top of it, or traffic starts to ride on it, the fines start to come out. And so the fines are beginning to slough away, and you start seeing some of the more heavier aggregate underneath, and it begins to look rough. And so that deterioration effect is called weathering and raveling. It's an environmental effect. The next is called transverse or longitudinal cracking. When a pavement is placed, and when you pave it, there are going to be cold joints. And those cold joints, as the pavement begins to age harden, begin to open up. And so that's where the longitudinal and transverse cracking also then ties together with the block cracking that you see in the next slide over. This, again, is an environmental type of a distress. The pavement is actually shrinking just a little bit. The volatiles are burning out of the structure, and so it needs to crack. Unlike concrete, where we can put in control joints and tell it to crack at that point, with pavement, we can't do that. And so if you drive down a road, as it begins to age harden, you'll begin to see that it will begin to block, shrinkage, crack, and it will be in like 20 by 20 squares is usually what you can anticipate right off the bat, and then it'll break down in 10 by 10 squares and smaller and smaller and smaller. The last slide is alligator cracking. Alligator cracking is a fatigue-related type of a distress. So the first three all had to do with the oxidizing effects, the environmental effects, sun and water. The last photo is the alligator cracking, which is fatigue-related. So the pavement is cracked and cracked and cracked, and the beginning, as it cracks, all of it begins to form on the top. We call it alligator cracking because it looks a lot like an alligator skin. And because it's cracking and bending and the tensile stress is along the bottom, if you think it looks really bad on the bottom or on the top, you should see what it looks like on the bottom, because that's where it's really pulling away. And so when you go out and look at your roads, now they're going to start talking to you. And because you're going to say, oh, there's alligator cracking. That's a fatigue-related loading type of a cracking. I wonder what kind of heavy vehicles I'm starting to see on my roads. One of the things that we might want to comment on is a lot of the roads are usually or haven't been designed for the amount of traffic related to the trash pickups, where we used to design it for one pickup a week. Now we have three different trucks, so it's consuming that pavement life faster than what it was initially designed for, and so your bank account is running out quicker. So let's review just quickly a couple of different types of what a PCI would be. This is a brand new road, and so it's 100, and so it has no defects, and that's why it gets a PCI of 100, and it's considered in excellent condition. This is a pavement. It has a rating of 85. The only distress here is weathering and raveling. It's beginning to wear off on the surface, and it just needs a surface treatment in order to be able to preserve it. Now at 70, we're beginning, the curve is starting to dip over, the deterioration curve, and we're starting to see some longitudinal and some transverse type crackings beginning to form. But this pavement is still considered in fair to good condition at 70. Now you're starting to see, and if you look very carefully, the block cracking that's there is starting in the corners to form some alligator cracking. So it's beginning to block crack, and it's beginning to progress to alligator cracking as the different traffic loading is beginning to drive over it. And so this is a PCI of 60. Still not horrible. You're going to be able to drive, and it's going to be a smoother ride. But it's beginning to exhibit conditions that we need to pay attention to. Now at 51, you're seeing a lot more alligator cracking. At 38, you're pretty much all alligator cracking. So we've gone from the environmental type of distresses, and now we're seeing the fatigue-related distresses begin to form. And now we're seeing a failed road. It's at 28. What's interesting about this slide is, and the educator part of me is coming out, if you look at the two sides, one is obviously more distressed than the other. And so then it begs the question, why? What's going on? And my suspicion is it might be a bus route that only runs one way, or that perhaps the garbage trucks only pick up on one side. Something's happening that one side is getting a lot more loading than the other side. And then, of course, this reminds us why we have pavement in the first place. Okay, now let's talk about some really important principles related to pavement preservation. Pavement preservation is defined as doing the right treatment to the right pavement at the right time using the right materials. Remember our original graph where we were talking about the deterioration curve. There are points along a pavement's deterioration curve that you need to apply certain types of treatments. You'll notice at the top there's crack sealing and seal coating up in the upper end. Down at the bottom, you're dealing more with reconstruction because it's in much worse condition. It's obvious that doing reconstructs on a road that only needs to be seal coated is wasting your money. Just the same as doing crack sealing on a pavement that really should be reconstructed is, again, wasting your money. And so the idea with pavement preservation is doing the right treatment at the right time to the right pavement. So with your pavement management system, we've gone out and we've assessed your system. And with pavement preservation, with pavement management, there are three different ways that you can try and manage your pavement system. And they're really quite simple to review. The first is best first. The second is worst first management, and then we're going to talk about critical point management. Best first management means that if we have limited money, we're going to spend all of our money on the best pavements that we have, and we're going to keep them in the best shape that we can. The problem with that is that over time, you'll have a whole bunch of good pavements and a whole bunch of bad pavements and nothing in between. So best first or top-down management is not sustainable in the long run. Worst first is also not sustainable. Worst first is dealing with the pavements that are in the worst condition. They're the ones at the end of the curve. And so when you're dealing with always spending your money on the worst pavements, you're spending the most amount of money that you can spend. And guess what? Because everything else is deteriorating, it's going to mean that you are always spending your money, the most money that you can, on your worst pavements. And so again, it's not sustainable in the long run. critical point management is best illustrated by looking at this graph. And then I have Luke over here because I kind of prompt them a little bit, because critical point management, for the benefit of the city council, means that you are, okay, my, it's not showing up there, but you can see the arrow, that if we were to take a deterioration curve and break it down into different portions, there is different amounts of money that you're going to spend for the various treatments. And so critical point management means that you're trying to catch the pavement right where you see the arrow, right there before it becomes more expensive, the next part down, and then right again at the next one down, and then you'll try and pick up some of your worst streets as well. And so you're taking everything from different categories right where you let the pavement deteriorate, and you can apply a treatment right at that optimum time and get the most life out of it, kick the pavement's condition back up again. By doing that, you end up taking the deterioration curve and kicking it out so that it gives you more time. And it preserves the life and extends its surface life. So critical point management is actually the best way to manage pavements, but then you also have to balance that with the other things that you're dealing with, because there's health and safety issues dealing with some of the worst pavements in town where you have large potholes, and perhaps there's trip fall hazards that you're dealing with, as well as making sure that you're always taking a look at your best pavements in town. But that's kind of hard to do when you've got a lot of bad pavements like a Tascadero has. It's really hard to say, well, now we're going to go out and spend some money on our really good pavements. But by doing that, you're actually being more fiscally responsible, and we'll show you why. In the long run, this slide's just a little bit busy, but in the long run, this is what shows what's going on. The top is managing your pavements by critical PCI. The bottom slide shows what happens if you go with worst first. I picked worst first because that's typically the knee-jerk reaction for managing your pavement system. Oh, just tell me what's the worst street in town, well, let's go do it. And so if you take on the bottom and do a worst first type of approach, wait till it gets to a trigger point and do an overlay, and then wait till it deteriorates and then do another overlay, over the course of time, and we picked close to 50 years over time, your average cost for your pavement is going to be $12 per square foot for maintaining that pavement if you take that type of an approach. By doing a critical PCI approach, you can see that the cost is going to be half the amount. But you're coming down the pavement, and when it's in good condition, you're applying a slurry seal, and then you're doing another surface treatment and another surface treatment, and you're trying to preserve that life before you have to do the overlay. By doing that, your costs are less, your pavement condition is better, and you're able to cover more pavement square footage with your dollars by doing this type of an approach. So let's talk about the asset findings that Atascadero has. You've got 139 centerline miles, approximately 18 or almost 19 million square feet of pavement. That is a lot of pavement. Your average PCI is a 47. That means half the streets are better than that and half the streets are worse than that. So your average is a 47. To give perspective, most cities try and set a goal for trying to maintain their system at about 70, and so that kind of gives you the gap of what we're dealing with. Your replacement value is $263 million. That's the cost of your asset. It's probably one of the most expensive assets that you have within the city that you're responsible for. Here's how your system breaks down by PCI range. And so we looked at the pavement in 10-point increments. The blue is your a representative of your arterials. Your red are your collectors, and your green ones are your residential. You can see when how the 47 comes about with your average right here, and you can also tell from this graph that your residential streets are in worse condition. What's interesting is as bad as some of the streets are, there was only very few that were in that last 10-point category. Your arterials, we broke it down by functional class, arterial, collector, and residential. Arterials were at a 58 average, and your collectors and residentials were 46 and 41 respectively. So let's talk about some strategies. When you're looking at a plan, and especially with a pavement management plan, it's important to know where you are and then define where you want to go, and then we can develop a plan to be able to get there. With this study, you now know where we are. And we know what the goal is to improve our pavements. Get the PCI as high as we can and preserve the life of our really critical asset that we have. Here's some strategies that we want to try and implement. So remember, we're talking about where we are, where we're going, and how to get there. The five-year plan is going to be critical for the city to be able to look at in terms of this is our way of what we're going to be doing it. Your five-year plan needs to have crack sealing as a portion of it. Crack sealing is the single most cost-effective treatment that you can do on a pavement. Unfortunately, it accentuates every single crack in the pavement. And so trying to balance that with crack sealing and then doing some kind of a surface treatment is usually the desired approach. But crack sealing in and of itself keeps the water out of the pavement and keeps the oxidizing of that pavement structure down to a minimum. We're going to be looking at expanding pavement preservation treatments and looking at, there's lots of different, California, you aren't alone in where you're at. And California is really trying hard, as well as the rest of the nation, to preserve their pavement assets. And everyone's getting really clever at how to apply different types of pavement preservation treatments. And so always keeping an ear to the ground, looking at those kind of treatments. Exploring a trench cut ordinance. My understanding is that's something that the city does not have right now. But when you do a brand new, you spend a lot of money on a street and then you cut into it because of an emergency from a utility or something like that, there should be some kind of consequences to that for not being able to plan things appropriately. And so other cities have implemented and used trench cut ordinances in a moratorium on their street cutting to be able to gain some of that impact back. Because as soon as you cut the street, the pavement condition begins to drop.
I think we lost the mic.
I can yell really loud now.
We need you for this.
Yeah. But while he's changing the batteries, you are entertaining. You've done a good job with this. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Mayor O'Malley. Thank you, sir. Okay. So preserving critical assets. That's really talking about your really important streets. Those are your arterial streets. They're the ones that most people, when they come into the city, those are the first streets that they're seeing. They make the impression. They're also the ones that carry the most loading and the most volume of traffic. And so those are the really critical assets. And so we're going to want to try and look at what we can do with that and balance that with the local and collector streets as well. Implementation of a maintenance rotation is a concept for pavement management where you try and work your way around the city on a rotational basis. And so that would be one thing that we would want to explore in terms of the impact for the city over time. The advantage of that is people know when the work is going to be happening. You keep the work close together, and so mobilization costs for construction stays low, and it's a way to be able to stretch your dollars by working around in a rotational manner in your city. We want to explore leveraging the limited funds that you have with grants. And so your arterial streets are the ones that are grant eligible streets. And so being able to look at your arterial streets, what grants are available, and then using matching funds to be able to extend and work with those streets, which may mean that if a street is eligible for a grant, but maybe not for a year or two, you would wait doing anything on that street until the grant funds are available. And so that's part of balancing the pavement management system as well. As well as considering other funding sources, I tend to get in trouble when I mention this, but we talked about the trash trucks. And I have seen, for example, agencies be successful in negotiating with the trash pickup services in terms of the impact that their vehicles are having on their city streets. And so that would be an example of funding sources. As well as partnering with projects, other agencies, and utility companies that are coming in to do projects, being able to balance and work with them to be able to say, oh, you're working on the street, then let's make sure that we also, you're going to do half of it, so let's spend our money to do the other half of it. And so, again, it stretches your money further down the road. And having a plan that implements these pieces are going to be able to help you get to where you're going with improved pavement condition. Now we're to the questions part.
Okay, we have Councilman Moreno, followed by Councilman Kelly.
A very thorough report, thank you. I'm curious, you had mentioned the trench cut ordinance moratorium, and you did say when utilities have emergencies and things like that. So how does that work with actually having a moratorium? Because to me that says there will be no trench cutting despite there being an emergency. And to me that seems like that doesn't work well. I could see requiring, you know, repair back to a certain standard, but what exactly is that?
What that is referring to is that if they need to cut into the street before the moratorium is up, and it's typically a five-year moratorium, then there's a fiscal impact to the utility for cutting into the street and consuming part of the pavement life.
Okay. And what would happen if, say, a resident needed to hook up to sewer? Then there would be a fiscal impact on that resident for something in that.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's kind of something you have to think about in terms of. But these are all things that I've seen other agencies do,
right,
to be able to help manage their pavements and keep them in good condition.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. We have Councilman Kelly followed by Councilman Fonzie.
That was an excellent report, very informative and educational. I noticed most of the subject was the surface that we actually see, the asphalt. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of road failures come from the subsurface or the foundation of the road. In your exploration, do you ever get into looking at the substructure of the road? So when we enter into repairing one of these roads, that we know it might be more than the $2.63 because we may have to pothole and where water is pumping and everything. Does your service provide any of that exploration work?
Absolutely. That's critical for being able to make sure that you're preserving your pavements and getting the most out of your money out of the construction that you're putting into it. So what's underneath the pavement is just as important as what's going on to the top of the pavement. And so existing cores, knowing what the thickness is, looking at the underlying soil structure in terms of an R value and its ability to be able to support the structure, gives you options to be able to say, okay, I can do this, it'll cost me this much and give me this much life. Then you can start doing some life cycle cost analysis and make sure that you're spending your money appropriately.
I know there's different mixtures of asphalt that can be provided, and I know the environment, weather. Does your company make a recommendation of maybe what the mixture should be for different roads for different weight conditions and what have you? Is that part of your service?
Yeah, there's different types of asphalt concrete that are available depending on the and different mix designs. What's interesting right now is that the asphalt industry is really experiencing a lot of different changes. We're being forced by, California is being forced by the feds to get in line with what they want to see happen. And so we're seeing a lot of different mix designs available, and there's pros and cons to those different mix designs. There's also other options that have to do with the recycling of rubberized asphalt and using those type of mix designs, and there's what times to use those and when it can greatly benefit you in terms of a design. Right.
I noticed all the different applications you had for repair and what have you. I didn't see chip seal in there. Do you ever recommend chip seal? Does that come in anywhere along the curve?
Yeah, it really comes right after a seal coat or a slurry seal. A chip seal, for those who are wondering, it's putting down a very heavy layer of oil and then sprinkling chips on top. It would be nice just to put the heavy layer of oil. That's really what you're trying to do, is seal up the cracks with a heavy layer of oil, but people can't drive on the slippery oil, so we put rocks inside on it, so that becomes what they ride on, is that. Atascadero has done chip seals in the past. There are pros and cons with chip seals. During the construction, there's the impact of the loose rock until it finally sets up, which can ding up cars and break windshields and do those kind of things. And so there's pros and cons. I happen to think that one of the most effective intermediate treatments that you can do is a rubberized chip seal, and then you put a slurry seal over the top of that. It gives a nice smooth surface over the top of it, and it's not a new pavement, but it will extend the pavement life for upwards of 7 years, and it's pretty cost effective.
I know you talked about the garbage companies. I know I happen to live on a cul-de-sac, and they just tear the cul-de-sac up. Do you have any examples of other cities or anything that you could share with us where we might be able to address that problem? Because I think they are a significant cause of some of our road failures in town.
Yeah, there have been cities that have successfully done studies, and there are studies available for that, and I'd be happy to work with staff and provide those to them.
Thank you very much.
We have Councilman Fonzie, followed by Councilman Sturdivant.
Great, thank you. Good report.
Thank you.
A question regarding the edges of the road that I noticed, that those are the ones that seem to fail, and sometimes it's trash truck related, it could be school bus, but sometimes I think it's the grading or perhaps the way that it's rolled onto there. It's thinner at the edges and thicker at the top of the road. Is that something that we can fix in Atascadero, because it seems to be fairly prevalent?
Yeah, that's resulting from, we refer to it in industry as unimproved roads, where it's just the pavement going right down the edge of the roads. It doesn't have the formal curb and gutter on it that's collecting the water and transferring it away. And so it's more of a rural type of a look of road. One of the maintenance treatments that you can do for that is something very simple called shoulder backing. And so you're taking that edge that after time the soil begins to wash away, and then as the trucks or heavier traffic drive on it, it begins to crack, and that's edge cracking. You put in shoulder backing up next to that and compact it in tight, and basically you're trying to hold in that edge. And so that's a common type of an inexpensive type of a treatment that you can do to maintain your edges.
That would be something that would be handled with the critical point as well.
Right.
And this is probably a silly question, but I've always wanted to ask it. When we have these very small earthquakes like we do in Atascadero, does mm-hmm. that actually affect the road, or is it elastic enough that it doesn't crack it?
That's a great question. And we were involved in the earthquake that occurred before and went out and evaluated several of your streets, and you were able to collect some money from FEMA because it was determined that the pavement was damaged by the earthquake. And so while we call them flexible pavements, because they, on a very microscopic level, they are flexing, but we all know from experience of falling on them that they're not very flexible. And so if we end up with an earthquake that shifts the underlying ground, because this is just a very thin layer over what's underneath, and if it moves, it's going to crack, yes.
Last question, and this is regarding springs, and we have several that are under roads that I have seen. Mm-hmm. They seem to disappear in the summer and come out in the earlier parts of the year after the rainy season. Is there any way to work with the springs, or do you just have to put in some kind of a drain or other?
Really, the only way you can work with them is by putting in some type of an edge system that will try and collect the water or pull the water away from the structure. Hopefully, we don't have roads that sit right on top of a spring.
Well, we do. We definitely do.
And then in that case, you need to be able to have some kind of a wicking system that drains the water away from it.
Right. They pop out the potholes every year, and then we fill them in, and they mm-hmm. come back. So.
Yeah. Right.
Thank you.
Good question. When it comes to pavement, we have lots of fun. They're never a bad question.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I can certainly see you're passionate about pavement, and I can understand now when you said that you lose sleep at night over. I can see how that could happen. So, a very good report. I've learned so much over this period of us talking about our roads and how to repair. And so if you could just kind of help me understand better the process between your company preparing the 5-year plan and then implementation on our part, and then how do we update and so know what the work that's been done. What work still needs to be done? How do we update that database so we can continue moving forward? How does that work?
That's a really good question. Your pavement management system is going to serve as the best way to be able to communicate the effectiveness of your plan. And so now you have your starting point, so that becomes your baseline study. And so everything that happens from this, we're going to be able to compare back to. All right, remember where we started? We were at 47. Are we improving? And as the treatments are applied, because we talked about many different types of pavement preservation treatments, we're going to want to watch them over time and be able to see, are we really getting the life out of them? Or this is very effective. We're blessed in this area that we have pretty mild climate that we're dealing with. We have Atascadero gets warm and it gets cold, but not like the rest of the country. And so we're able to get more pavement life that way. So your pavement management system is going to be your reporting tool. As far as implementation or development of the 5-year plan, it's going to involve, as I see it and as we've talked about it, it's going to talk about specific, these are the roads that we're going to be working on this year and then the next year and the next year, with the idea that the road selection is going to be utilized from the program, because we're trying to hit critical PCI pavement and we can't keep track of all of that in our head, so we're using the program to be able to select the treatments and be able to look at different options. What impact is doing this type of a rotation or doing, I guess what I'm saying in my mind without going on and on, is we're going to run various scenarios to be able to come up with the optimum approach to be able to work our way down year by year with these are the streets that we need to do that are going to have the biggest impact for a positive PCI. Now, what's interesting is as your pavement improves, you're going to see the strategies begin to change. And so updating the pavement management system, again, is going to give feedback, but it's also going to be able to tell us, all right, what's our next strategy? How do we need to watch for this? And so you usually will see the pavement management system updated on about an every 3-year type of an approach. Your 5-year plan is really dug into, again, about every 3 years, but each year you're assessing it to be able to see how the impact is. You might have better construction prices, which means that you've already selected streets in year two, and because of the really good prices, you want to grab some of those streets and throw them into the year one work. And so that already means that your plan is out of whack, and you would need to, on an annual basis, also review your plan. But as you do that little bit of planning along the way, the cost for doing that is minimal.
So the planning is done by us, or you're basically setting us a 5-year plan, more or less, and then from there we're working the plan, updating it through the program, and making changes accordingly as to where we were, where we are, and how well we're doing.
Right, exactly. Okay. We're available also to be able to do that. That's one thing that our firm does. We just deal with pavements and existing pavements. We don't necessarily go out and do the new pavements. We want to deal with existing pavements because we see those as the more challenging.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So, Councilwoman Moreno, did you have another question?
So I'm curious if at the point when we go to extend this and say, you know, we really need a 10-year, is there a benefit to doing a 10-year now? Or maybe it sounds like, based upon the answer you just gave, that you're continually looking at it for various factors, and so maybe the 5-year mark to do another 5 isn't like doing a whole nother system, but you would just keep adding on. Is that the case, or is there some benefit to going out 10 years today?
You know, that's really a good question. You would think that would be really, you think further ahead planning would be better, but with pavement, it's 5-year chunks work pretty well.
Okay.
Because things change so much. You're deteriorating, your other effects are causing you to evaluate what's working and what isn't working.
Okay. Thank you. And I just have to say, this whole time Nick's just been smiling, so he really does love this stuff.
I do.
We've had some fun conversations about it. It's kindred spirits here.
We have Councilwoman Fonzie, followed by Councilman Kelly.
Thank you. So does this come with some software that can be used by Nick or others in our staff that can update it and keep the database fairly current, or is this something that means you have to come back every so often and update it yourself?
No, actually, the city purchased the software that we used 2 years ago. And then city staff, we actually were, Russ Thompson asked us to come in and train some of the staff to be able to go out and do the PCI ratings and do some of those things. The problem was is that they were so busy that they weren't able to get that taken care of, and so there was a desire to say, look, we've just got to know where we are. We got to start somewhere. And so we were contracted to come in and provide that baseline point. But there are agencies that utilize their own staff to do this. The program that you bought, I happen to think is actually your license to use, is the best pavement management program that there is available out there on the market because of its ability to run detailed scenarios and be very specific with the type of treatments and the strategies that you want to try and utilize. It's online. And so it's server-based, so you can access it as long as you can link in. Any of you can get the password to log in to be able to see what's going on with it. I hope you don't mind, Nick, but that's true. I wanted to speak the truth on that. It's available to staff, and a lot of people find it a very useful tool. There's a GIS portion, so you can click on it and say, oh, show me a map of how my PCIs are, and you can get a map. It's probably easier for you just to say, Nick, get me a map, and he'll get you one, as opposed to getting into the program and doing it yourself.
So, Nick, are you already trained on this, or we need to send you to get trained as well?
Councilmember Fonzie, I did not have any of the training with PEI. That was before my time. However, I started out my career actually doing this for the city of Davis in the early 1990s. I was hired to basically set theirs up. They didn't have it, and I went through and set it up. So I'm very familiar. They had a different system. But as Joe mentioned, the Street Saver, which the city has a license to operate, was actually these are really complicated. Some of these programs are really, really complicated. We want a simple one. And actually, the Street Saver was developed by a number of public works directors that didn't want a really complicated program and have a staff member that is so has to have so much training and be using it all the time to be really, I guess, knowledgeable about the program. So Street Saver is a very simple, it's still very powerful. It's a great analysis tool for running different scenarios and, you know, what-if scenarios. And so it's a program that I plan to get to know and have staff know. So my ultimate intention is to have staff take this over once we get fully staffed and get this program underway.
Very good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Councilman Kelly.
Yes, I noticed during the presentation you had an estimated price per foot. Mm-hmm. And I know in a lot of trades like concrete, even asphalt, that you have to bring a certain amount of equipment out there to do it. So is there a break-off point where there's a minimum of square footage, or if you start doing more, it gets cheaper or cheaper? And when we start planning to do these repairs, do we put the whole program together to make sure we're getting the most for our dollar by maybe doing a road here, maybe the one next door to it or something at the same time? Otherwise, it could become very expensive when we wouldn't get a return on our investment.
Absolutely, and that those are the things that we want to be able to incorporate into the plan. That was the rotational aspect of the plan, focusing in on certain areas so that we maximize or minimize the construction mobilization costs and therefore maximize the amount of pavement that you're able to do.
Great, thank you. I think I'm convinced you really do know what you're doing. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a few questions for you. You touched on one a little bit earlier, but if you know our city, in the old days, you could dig a hole 10 foot down downtown and hit water. We have a very high water table, mm-hmm. and we have a lot of adobe soils. And again, when the main streets were planned, there wasn't the vision of the vehicles that we would have today. And I'm concerned about that underlying structure of, I know in some cases you might like to see 18 inches of compacted base underneath before we start looking at pavement, and we may or may not have that. And I've had this question to other engineers, at what point is it actually better to start over? And have you seen any of those cases, or does that really take a soils analysis? Because I think it's one of those things that if we're really thinking long-term, big picture, are there some streets that we really need to bite the bullet and just start over?
That's a great question, Mayor, in terms of, and to answer it, through my career, the amount of times where I've had to start over has been a function of an increase of traffic that has been exponential. Mm-hmm. We're working with a city down in Southern California and have for the last 10 years with their pavement management system and designs. And no one ever dreamed that the city was going to grow as fast as it did. And so we talk about loading of pavement. It's we refer to it as traffic index, and without boring you with a lot of stuff, it was designed for a 7, and the streets are being loaded at an 11, which means that you just kind of have to start over. What we're working with there is the outside lanes of their major arterials are the ones that are taking all the loading. And so we're actually doing value engineering type design where we focus on that outside lane to beef it up to an 11, but then on the inside lanes deal with the traffic loading that it gets. And so while the structure looks different in cross-section from the driving public, it's the same and it performs the same. And so the other thing that I think of with your poor soils, there's different types of treatments that you can do in place to be able to keep them without having to say, all right, time to rip it all out and start over, because the impact of that to an existing roadway is huge. You can't even begin to calculate the cost that would be in terms of of lost opportunities for people or whatever. You can do the construction costs. And so there's ways to be able to recycle pavement and utilize different type of soil amendments, the common being cement or lime, and actually pulverizing in the existing asphalt layer and pulverizing it into the existing base and native soil and mix in some of this amendment to create that thicker, stronger base section, and then put your asphalt layer over the top of it. All of that's evaluated when we approach pavement design. We do deflection testing and we do coring to be able to determine what is the pavement, where is it at in its deterioration cycle, and what does it need to be able to be rehabilitated.
Thank you. Well, some of my questions come from having been on San Luis Council of Governments, where we're dealing with bigger projects and that kind of stress loads. And mm-hmm. is there a basic alternative that you can look at almost mathematically that is an alternative to having less underlying structure and base, that you just simply keep adding pavement on? Is there a point of no return, or does it, how would you look at that?
Really, the point of no return with piling asphalt on top of asphalt, which is, you know, overlay on top of overlay on top of overlay, is you have to look at your vertical constraints. And so if you've got existing curb and gutter, that's not going anywhere. You're not going to raise your curb and gutter or your sidewalk with each overlay. And so what happens is that road gets more and more and more crowned, and we call it quarter crowning. It becomes very steep on those sides. And we've all parked in places like that and had our doors swing open and think, wow, this is really a pain, and trying to get in and out of this. And so your vertical constraints are what stop you. For the city of Atascadero, where we have unimproved roads,
right,
we can pile higher and deeper in terms of an option, as long as we aren't affecting the existing drainage along the edge of the road and we can transition properly in and out of the driveways.
So there's no really downside due to stacking the pavement, as long as you can deal with the drainage and we don't have those vertical constraints in our, especially in our residential areas. And that's not bad strategy to just look at overlays.
Now, one thing with an overlay is an overlay is designed to get you 10 years. It's analogous to if you were to re-roof your house and you didn't take off the old shingles and you put on the new shingles right over the old shingles, your new ones are not going to last as long. And so a brand new pavement is designed to last 20 years, where an overlay is going to give you 10 years. And so you're getting half the life if you just do an overlay. But it's a lot less expensive to do an overlay than it is to do a whole complete removal and replacement of the existing asphalt and try and deal and mitigate with the existing cracking conditions.
And I guess that's kind of my question, especially in the residential areas where you don't have the vertical constraints. Is it more cost effective to just continually add overlays every 10 years rather than looking at some point maybe you're grinding up in places, sometimes we've done, or you're using a fabric overlay with a pavement overlay. I assume that that's just part of the equation that you evaluate then what's the most cost effective from an economic standpoint.
And that's exactly right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump on your question.
You're fine.
I'm excited to talk about it.
I'm excited for an answer.
Besides overlays, you mentioned some where you pulverize and pulverize it in place and recycle it in place. That saves trucking costs, and so again it keeps your costs down low. The other thing that can happen is something that is you mill out the existing layer. So if your asphalt layer is thicker on there, and so therefore it's a structurally adequate pavement, but the cracking conditions warrant some type of rehabilitation, you can mill off a layer of the existing asphalt and then put back a new layer of asphalt on top of it. Oftentimes that ties right exactly in with the existing elevation, and so from a transitional point of view, no one feels anything different as far as driving on it, except we have a brand new road.
And you'd mentioned this too, I think we've looked at wanting to see when we're working on road projects, possibly just extending the shoulder to some degree because it helps on walking, bicycling, and a lot of our rural roads. But it sounds like there's an actual benefit to extending the life of the road where we have that kind of a drop down because the other materials, you know, eroding away. There's some value in doing compacted base shoulders, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And it's actually going to preserve the life of the pavement as well as providing a walking surface, for example.
The other thing that can happen along those lines, and we did it on a design for Portola as we came off of 41 heading northbound, we had a lot of water that was coming down that section of road right there, and so we wanted to try and contain it because it was eroding out the edges of the pavement. And so that was the situation where we actually, during the overlay process, extended out the shoulders a little bit further and put in some AC berms on the edges to contain that water and control where it was going to be going so it didn't just erode and wash away the edges of the pavement. So all of that is put together into the design process to try and figure out how to, because water and pavement don't get along, and so we want to try and minimize the impact of that.
Thank you. And I assume that's part of the analysis when you're looking at the roads, because a lot of the issues are drainage, and you factor that in where sometimes we need to improve the drainage to really improve the road, and that would be part of the analysis.
Exactly. You're going to see where the road's failing because of the water, not the drainage conditions that are there. Keep in mind that your pavement management system is a network level analysis. You're kind of looking from up here down to be able to see what's going on with my pavement. It's a budgeting tool, but it's not a detailed design tool. And so when you are able to then select your streets and you have a budget number to be able to work with, then you're able to go out and do the actual detailed design. And what you find happens is oh, this street didn't cost as much, oh, this one did cost more, and it all balances out as you implement the specific project level design.
Okay, thank you. Any other council questions? Well, excellent job. I'm going to open it up to the public to see if anyone would like to come forward with questions on this topic. Seeing no one run to the lectern, we'll close public comment.
Oh, no.
You've done great. And thank you. I didn't think anyone could keep up with pandas or singing choir members, but very, very good presentation. We're back to the council. I think we're ready for a motion or further deliberation.
I'm ready to move staff's recommendation.
Second.
We have a motion by Mayor Pro Tem Moreno, seconded by Councilman Sturdivant. Roll call, please.
Councilmember Sturdivant?
Yes.
Councilmember Kelly?
Yes.
Councilmember Fonzie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Moreno?
Yes.
Mayor O'Malley?
Yes.
5-0, motion passes.
Let me check to see if we need a little break before we can go on at this point. Are we okay? Bob, I'm looking at you because it's you and me. If we can make it, okay. Anybody can make it if Bob and I can make it. Okay, we're going to move on to concealed carry weapons licensing. Chief Haley.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor and Council. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you tonight on the issue. So that you guys are aware, I cannot bring up my notes on my computer for some reason, so I'm going to wing it here. I don't think I'll leave anything out. I should be able to touch on all the points that we need to discuss. This should be just a receive and file type of issue and item that we bring before the council tonight, although there is one item in dealing with concealed carry weapons permits that would like input from council on, and I'll advise you of that as we go through this. Anytime during this presentation that we refer to CCWs, we are referring to concealed carry weapons permits. And so I wanted to kind of just give you a little bit of a background first on, you know, what's changed. Why all of a sudden are we talking about this? For the information of council and the public,
Gun laws have not changed, and this does not have anything to do with the right to keep and bear arms or anything to do with those issues. Specifically, this deals with those individuals in our community who have a desire for one reason or another to have the ability to carry a firearm concealed on their person. That is one thing that is not allowed under our current laws unless the person registers for and is given a concealed carry weapons permit. The laws that govern that are found in the Penal Code under 21655 and some other laws surrounding 21655. Primarily what that says is that the police chief in any jurisdiction with a population under 200,000 people has the authority to grant concealed carry weapons permits, CCW permits, to residents, and then the sections that follow outline what the requirements and restrictions on that are. In that section, 21655, it says that the police chief can, by agreement with the county sheriff, forfeit that right and give the sheriff the authority on his behalf to make decisions about who has the ability and the responsibility to carry concealed carry weapons. We have, by kind of the best way to describe it is gentleman's agreement, had the sheriff doing that on our behalf for about the last 15 years, maybe a little bit more. I don't have the exact date and the history of that. But for at least the last 15 years, when people have come to the Atascadero Police Department and requested a CCW permit, the department has issued them a letter saying that we do not decide permits and referring them to the sheriff's department. And the sheriff's department has, on our behalf, undertaken the process of determining what individuals will be allowed to carry concealed weapons or not. Recently, what has occurred is there was a decision at the Ninth Circuit level that made some individuals believe that there was going to be fewer restrictions on the number of CCW permits that were going to be issued. I don't want to get into all of the totality of the case law, but one of the provisions of deciding whether somebody is eligible for a CCW permit or not is whether they can show good cause. And that was something that many police chiefs used to deny permits because people did not have good cause. The Ninth Circuit decision that was recently undertaken, according to many people, decided this good cause issue, but in reality it did not. And that case is under appeal right now. We have conferred with the city attorney on that and believe that good cause exception still does exist and should be used based on current law in the state of California. And I won't get into much more of the specifics of the Ninth Circuit decision, but if you ask, I can give you more details on that, why that is not the way the decision was rendered. And so as a result of that case law, the Sheriff's Department has seen a pretty dramatic increase in the number of applications coming to their department from not only the city of Atascadero, but a couple of other jurisdictions that they were also responsible for handling the CCW permits. And so they have asked those jurisdictions now, all of them, to go back to issuing their own, thereby putting the requirements back onto the chief of police in those jurisdictions. And that's really what's happened now, and that's why we're coming before you, just notifying you of this change. So how are CCWs issued? There really is a process that is spelled out by state statute. None of this is to the whim or fancy of any particular chief of police. We are required to follow this process. And that's why we're not coming before the council asking you to give us permission to do this. It really is already all spelled out under statute, and we are simply following the provisions of current law as it exists. The first is that a multi-phased application has to take place. There are applications through the Department of Justice that somebody is required to submit and an application process through the local agency, us. What our department has done as part of this is to create a kind of a pamphlet that we will hand out to people that walks them through the process. It is a difficult process, and so it walks them through as best we possibly can, demonstrating to them what the steps will be that they need to go through in order to not only apply for the CCW, but to have one issued. And so the application process is that first step. There are a number of fees that are associated with the CCW application process. One of them we brought before council last week. That is the only one that is actually a fee that comes to the city of Atascadero. The other fees will go to the Department of Justice or to the private entities that are responsible for the evaluation and or training of the individuals who have applied for the license. For instance, there's a fee associated with taking a firearms course that is required by state law. That fee will be paid directly to the entity that is providing that course. The city of Atascadero doesn't provide that. There is a fee for somebody who takes a psychological exam. That fee is paid directly to the psychologist who is providing the exam. We don't collect that. There are fees that we do collect. Now, one is a fingerprinting fee. That's already on our fee schedule. We already do collect that. It actually goes to the Department of Justice. We don't keep that money. We are simply the processing agency. We take in the check. At the end of the month, the Department of Justice sends us a bill for all of those fingerprints that have been processed, and then we return the money to the Department of Justice in a single check rather than just mailing them a bunch of individual personal checks. So there are those types of fees that will be associated with this process. And then finally, there is a fee for our time. The state has allowed for the city of Atascadero to collect a small fee to help us with the cost, manpower costs and other costs associated with processing CCW permits. It is a standard fee that is set by statute. We don't have the ability to raise it or lower it. It's $100. And until the statute changes, that's what the fee will be. We are allowed to collect 20% of that fee, $20 up front, and the remainder of the fee is charged once the CCW license is issued. The $20 is ours, though. We're not giving that back. Once somebody applies, then there is a pretty lengthy process and a review process that takes place. First and foremost, they have to go through all of the Department of Justice testing. They have to make sure that they can prove that they're of good character. There are things that they have to submit to us, like letters documenting their good character by other residents in the community. Ultimately, the chief of police is the deciding factor, and I review all of the information provided to determine and make a final determination on whether somebody has shown good cause and gone through all of the steps necessary. And so every application that comes through will be ultimately landing on my desk, and I will make a decision, yay or nay, on whether somebody should be issued a CCW. There are various steps along that review process where they could be kind of kicked out of the system automatically and it would never get to me. For instance, if somebody is found to have a conviction of a felony crime, that would come back in their Department of Justice review, and that would be an automatic disqualification. If we decide to go through with a psychological testing and the psychologist determines that somebody is not suitable, then that would actually be an automatic disqualification. And those are ones that wouldn't ultimately end up on my desk. So there are some, I've mentioned a few of these, and these are just kind of the high points, and so I'm going to present them to you. But who can be issued a CCW? First of all, it has to be a resident of Atascadero. That should be the very first one. I cannot issue CCWs to anyone who does not reside within our community, and we wouldn't want to expend the time and effort on that anyway. We want to concentrate on our own residents. So they have to be a resident of Atascadero. They have to prove in some way that they're of good moral character. That's also outlined in statute for how they do that. They have to attend an approved firearms course, show proficiency with the weapon that they're going to be using or carrying concealed, and undergo some instruction to make sure that they know what they're doing. They have to have a registered weapon. It can't be one that you found on the street somewhere. It actually has to be registered. And then ultimately they have to show just cause. That is the issue that many people thought was decided by the Ninth Circuit decision. Again, this is somebody coming into the police department and showing something above and beyond just a general fear for their own safety. It would have to be more pronounced than that. And I, as the chief of police, would make that final determination on whether the cause that was just cause, whether they actually had a reasonable need to carry a concealed weapon. One of the other provisions that is optional, it's actually the only one that's optional by statute, is whether we require people to undergo psychological testing before they're issued a CCW. Psychological testing is not used by every department. Locally, the Sheriff's Department has not been requiring people to undergo psychological testing. The Paso Robles Police Department, however, has been doing their own CCW permits for a number of years, and they do require that people undergo psychological testing. The state has mandated that the psychologist we use will be the same psychologist that we use for our own police officer evaluations. When somebody's getting hired by the police department, we're required to send them for psychological testing. The psychologist that we use refers back to us a recommendation of suitable or not suitable based on their evaluation. And then if they're suitable, we will hire them as a police officer potentially. We have a relationship with our psychologist. We know them. We trust their judgment. It won't be some fly-by-night organization that we send people to. We are very confident that we will receive good information back from our psychologist, and that this additional kind of phase of testing will make sure that when we do issue a CCW, we're making sure that the right person has the CCW. In general, I, as a police chief, am not opposed to CCWs. I actually am in favor of them, but I want to make sure that we as a community, we as a city, are doing everything we can to have a stringent examination of the applicants so that when we do issue one, we have a confidence in the individual who we've issued it to. And I think that the psychological testing is one additional criteria that we can use and has shown itself to be valuable for the other agencies who've used it. There is going to be some impact to our community and specifically to the police department from the issuance of CCWs. I don't quite fully know what to expect just yet. I know that the Sheriff's Department has seen an increasing number of requests, and currently the Sheriff's Department has issued 54 concealed carry weapons permits in the city of Atascadero. Fortunately for us, they have offered, and we have gladly accepted to allow them to continue to maintain those 54. They won't transfer over to us the maintenance of those. They will continue on a yearly basis to confer with the individuals who have those licenses and make sure that they're still eligible and reissue the licenses. So we'll only be required to handle new licenses that come in. Our neighbor to the north in Paso Robles, by contrast, has only issued 3 CCWs. And so somewhere in between 54 and 3 is where we'll land, and I'm not sure exactly where that will be. So dependent upon the number of applicants that we have, we will determine at that point what the overall physical impact is to us in terms of staff time and fee collection, all the other requirements. We don't know yet what we don't know. And so if we determine at some point in time that there's a significant physical impact based on the issuance of CCWs, we may try and make some determinations in the future about what to do and how to try and offset that. For right now, we don't anticipate any significant fiscal impact. I think the processing time will be relatively small, and most of the work is done by others, Department of Justice, the psychologists, range staff at whatever local gun range these people want to go to. The only real thing that we have some discretion on is the psychological testing. Everything else is pretty spelled out clearly by statute. We don't have a lot of choice in it ourselves. We'd love to have tons of local control. We talk about that a lot as city staff and as a council. But unfortunately, the state has kind of restricted us to following their guidelines along most of this. Although having the ability to kind of control it rather than leaving it in the sheriff's hands does give us a little bit of autonomous control over who has these permits in our residence or in our community, excuse me. The one thing that we do have discretion over is whether we have people go through psychological testing or not. It is my recommendation, it's my belief that that is the best way to go and that this will be the best for our community. But certainly council can, ask questions and make decisions and provide direction to staff on whether you feel that that level of testing is appropriate for those people involved in the CCW permit process. And so therein is the one area of recommendation that I would be willing to, I would like to hear from council on whether you feel that my direction is appropriate or not. And then we're going to just open it up for questions and any discussion that you might have to me.
So, council questions. Councilwoman Fonzi, followed by Councilwoman Moreno.
So I wanted to talk about the psychological testing as well. Actually, it's a fairly high fee. I understand it's a psychologist and they cost money, but it increases it from $500 to $650, which is a fairly expensive proposition for certain people. What are your thoughts about that cost?
We've talked with the psychologist. The fee is actually greatly reduced from what they would normally charge. The fee is prescribed by state law. And so they are willing, the psychologists are willing to do it for us at a reduced cost, reduced from what they would normally charge somebody for testing of a similar nature. And so while it is an increase in the overall fee that we would be charging somebody, it is dramatically reduced from what somebody would have to pay if psychologists were able to just kind of willy-nilly decide what they were going to be paying. They've done that for the city of Paso Robles. They've agreed to do that for us because they think it's a benefit to the community. My statement to that would be, yes, it is a little bit of an increased cost, but we are attempting through the use of this additional testing method to reduce kind of the liability to our community and the safety to our residents by putting a gun in a concealed manner in the hands of maybe the wrong person. And so I think that that is, you know, by its very nature, invaluable to us to have that additional kind of stringent examination. And I don't know that we really could put a price on that. If somebody's already able to come up with $500, you know, maybe an extra $150 just to make sure that they're the right person for this isn't quite so bad. We are aware that the cost is quite high, and that does keep many people from applying. We are aware of that as well. But ultimately, as I said, we want to make sure we have the right people with a CCW permit as opposed to somebody who may ultimately end up doing some harm to one of our residents or somebody in our community.
May I answer the question similar?
Yes, you may, but I do have a further one.
Yeah, just along that line, is this an annual reoccurring fee or is this a one-time fee for that psychological?
The psychological test would be one-time. Many of the fees are annual. Some of the fees are annual. The Department of Justice requires an annual fee. City of Atascadero's fee is a one-time fee. There is a smaller renewal fee that we charge, and I think that's $25 a year. And there is a small fee if you change addresses of $10 to have us change things on your license. But as far as the psychological testing, the class that you have to take, the firearms course, and our initial $100 fee, those are all one-time fees.
How long would it take to have a psychological test? And the reason I'm asking this is I'm just wondering how effective it really is that many people go through psychoanalysis for months or years. And I think you probably can learn a great deal from that. But if you see somebody for 45 minutes and there are certain medical questions I know you cannot ask them under HIPAA laws, how do we know that it's actually productive?
Well, the psychologist is able to ask them a great many questions that we would not be able to ask because they are a medical practitioner. And so there are a good number of questions. And we actually don't get a report back that has all of those answers and all of that information in it because of those HIPAA laws. We simply get a report back that says either suitable or not suitable. There is no set time for the examination. I know that the psychologist will have them do certain written examinations prior to the verbal, one-on-one communication that they will have with the individuals. We have found that the psychologists actually do a pretty good job for us in their testing with our police officers. There have been a number of times when an individual has come back as unsuitable for hire, and we've later found that absolutely, that was somebody we really didn't want on our department. I've developed a great deal of trust in our psychologists and in the practice and the methods that they use. They know what they're doing for us, and I believe that we can be confident that in the even though short amount of time that they're dealing with somebody, they can look for those key indicators that would make somebody unsuitable to have a CCW permit issued.
This may sound a little odd, but the thought comes to my mind. It was a reason I began this line of questioning and actually asked Rochelle about the psychological testing, is because so many veterans come back from war, and they have a minor amount of PTSD. It's almost customary that they do at this day and age. And I'm just wondering if most veterans would find that they are out of the loop. They can't get a CCW because if they're asked, do you have PTSD, and they may have 5%. My husband has about that amount. My son has a little more. They both were in Iraq. And I'd hate to see the veterans who are fighting and doing the things to preserve our rights to carry arms actually dealt out of the process.
So two answers to that. First and foremost, we want to make sure that we're being clear. Nothing that we're talking about with CCWs would reduce or eliminate someone's right to carry firearms. They simply have to carry them in the way that's prescribed by law. A veteran with PTSD, for instance, still has a right to own a firearm, still has a right to carry it in their vehicle, for instance. They just have to do it in a way that is prescribed by law. We are talking a very small percentage of the population that we are allowing to carry them concealed on their person. That's very different. And so just because someone's excluded from the CCW process for one reason or another doesn't necessarily restrict or limit their rights to a firearm, to have a firearm. With regard to what you're talking about, it's impossible for me to know, because I'm not in those psychological examinations, at exactly what point somebody with PTSD, for instance, or some other issue may be deemed unsuitable to a psychologist. I don't get that information. I don't know, for instance, necessarily how many of my own police officers have some form of PTSD from some event or another. I think what the psychologists are always doing is looking at the overall picture. Is somebody likely or not likely to have some sort of problem if we allow them to become a police officer, carry a firearm, and make judgments based on, the actions that they're involved in? I think the same rules would apply here. And I have, again, a great deal of confidence in those individuals that we use for the psychological testing. I suspect that they would not simply eliminate somebody who has a recognition and a realization that, yeah, I got a little bit of PTSD and sometimes I just don't feel right. Those would be the individuals we'd actually probably say, all right, they're very self-aware. They know when and where they have issues. And I doubt they would be restricted from a CCW just because of some limited amount of PTSD. Again, I'm surmising and guessing a whole bunch.
Excellent guessing. Councilwoman Moreno, followed by Councilman Sturdivant.
Chief, I was curious about the just cause. Is that decided up front before the applicant goes through the whole process and pays hundreds of dollars in fees?
So not necessarily. First and foremost, they wouldn't pay hundreds of dollars in fees. For instance, we would only charge $20 up front to process the application. If we determine that there was not just cause, they're not going to get their $20 back, but they're not paying the full $100.
Okay.
Yes, we certainly wouldn't want somebody to go all the way through the process, pay for psychological testing,
yep,
pay for a good
the
many of other things,
training,
the firearms training,
yes,
and whatnot. If we looked at it and said, this doesn't meet our criteria, we would want to have a rigorous examination of that prior to sending someone and causing them to spend a good deal of their money and time, which is also valuable on that. We'll look over those applications as they come in, and any red flags that come up, we'll say, okay, let's halt the process here and go a different direction.
Okay, that's exactly what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Councilman Sturdivant.
Actually, just a comment is that everyone in my industry has gone through the psychological examination, including myself, and it's a very good tool for my industry to figure out who should and should not be hired and trustworthy and those kind of things in the positions that we're in. So I see this as a tool for you to help you make a decision and to be really informed as to who you are giving a license to and the safety of that person carrying a concealed weapon in our city. So, I support the psychological testing.
Any other council questions or comments? And I would say I also had questions about the psychological. Just one, it's optional, and two, I had concerns of having worked in the mental health profession for 30 years. I worked with many psychiatrists, psychologists, and other professionals. some I would trust and some I wouldn't trust to make such a decision. Some would even feel that there's a liberal bias in some areas, but I especially liked that it's required that someone that's really experienced in this particular area, you've got someone that we're trusting to make decisions about law enforcement folks, and if we're going to require that we have a psychological on someone that's going to be a law enforcement person that we have a lot of contact with and supervision, seems like we certainly ought to want to do that with someone that we aren't going to have a lot of follow-up with. So I have less concern about that, and I also trust the evaluation process that, again, it's in a very short time you can determine that someone is paranoid or reacts under stress in a way that might cause harm to someone else. So I think there's enough things that could be weighed out. My experience is I don't think post-traumatic stress disorder would necessarily be something that would be an issue. So I'm pretty comfortable with the process and want to have you have a maximum discretion, because it really comes down to your decision and as a police chief. And I think we want to have you have every tool you feel you might need. Our job is to help you protect our community. And I think we're certainly a council that wants to have maximum freedom and flexibility. But you might just touch on, because I think it's on people's minds about, well, okay, see, concealed weapon versus walking around town carrying a gun. Well, just what would be your reaction or a police officer's reaction? I'll tell one anecdotal story that I had to do on KPRL today, because this was a topic for quite a while. But growing up in Atascadero, a bunch of us kids, really high school, would grab our 22s. We'd walk down the state highway, go down to Grisanti's, buy a box of shells, go down the river, shoot a few tin cans. We'd actually go over to the fire station afterwards, where my dad was a fireman, and there was shift change for all the police and highway patrol in the area, playing cribbage. Can you believe that? And we'd lean our rifles up against the windowsill, and you know, one of the highway patrolmen would say, "Oh, been out big game hunting, huh?" Now I'm thinking today, if a group of high school kids was walking down a state highway carrying rifles, they'd have a different experience than I did growing up. Just what would the reaction be? How does law enforcement look at folks carrying weapons that aren't concealed, and how would that be handled?
It actually has been a significant issue for law enforcement lately. There is a movement throughout the United States for people who talk about an open carry process, and we've seen incidents where individuals will walk down the street, for instance, with an unloaded assault rifle and actually taunt law enforcement in a way, trying to bait them into what they deem a constitutional issue and see if the officers will make an arrest. And what I really have concerns about more than anything is the safety and security of our public. We have seen over the course of the last couple of decades an increasing number of incidents where dramatic violence is carried out with firearms at our schools, local shopping areas, in meeting places just like this. And so an individual choosing to kind of confront in the way through this open carry process, walking down the street with an unloaded firearm just to make a point, could potentially not only cause fear and panic within the community, but could himself or herself become subject to violence from somebody else who's coming down the street and doesn't quite know what they're doing. And so I do have some concerns about it. In answer to your question, that's a long way of getting around to saying, you know, we certainly would have serious concerns if we saw somebody walking down the streets in Atascadero now with a rifle, you know, slung over their shoulder or with an exposed firearm. It just is out of place in our current society and the current standards for, modern behavior in places where we congregate. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen, simply something of a concern. Even more so, a concern is, you know, who has a concealed carry weapon, who has the permit to carry that, versus who's carrying it illegally. Our police officers come into contact with hundreds of individuals every month. Many of those individuals are armed. There was a story in the news recently where an individual that was stopped on a traffic stop had a loaded assault rifle unregistered and, you know, highly dangerous type of a weapon. We come into contact with those individuals on a regular basis. Having some local control over who has a concealed carry weapon permit gives us the ability to kind of know who we're dealing with, who we're not dealing with, and when we do find someone in possession of a firearm that's concealed on their person, how we react to that can be, in some cases, life or death. And so having that control really will benefit our department in the long run, I believe.
Well, thank you for bringing it back to topic anyway. One last question, just because it's a parallel issue. I'm assuming that I haven't heard of any issues, but anyone who's involved in hunting or going to target practice out at the shooting range that we have, you haven't had any problems with folks engaged in those kind of activities. I assume maybe if they come in contact with law enforcement, there might be some questioning or not, but you haven't seen any problems with our rural character and folks engaging in hunting or target shooting.
Yeah, none whatsoever. We have a healthy respect for firearms, I think, in the community of Atascadero. And when we do come across somebody who is in possession of a firearm legally, we find that they're very open with it, have presented that information to law enforcement during that first contact. And that's, for us, that's the best we could hope for. Makes for an easy contact.
Thank you. We do have some questions from Councilman Kelly, who actually has some experience in this area.
Yes. I support your program 100%. This is maybe a more serious issue than maybe some of you think. The education of carrying the gun is really, really important. And I think isn't it a two-year permit? I know I have one, and it's a two-year deal, not an annual.
There are four different kinds of permits. Okay. One is 90 days, one is 2 years. That's right. The most common that's issued. One is three, and one is four.
Right. And I think it's really, really important that the initial phase, that somebody really gets checked out. Well, I've seen abuses of concealed weapons permit. And as a former law enforcement person, I've picked a couple up. And the closest I ever came to shooting somebody on the highway patrol was a person that had a concealed weapon. And I still think about that, watching the hammer come back on the gun. So it's a really, really serious deals, not anything just to give out. We want to make sure that we get the right person that has it and they don't turn out to be cowboys out on the street thinking that they can save the world. So I support your program 100%.
And lastly, well, we have a couple more questions. On the permit, having worked at the Sheriff's Department in the past too, it used to be there was a limit of up to three weapons that had to be listed on the permit. Is there still a limitation?
It's down to two now.
Okay.
So. Thank you. We've narrowed the field.
Narrowed the field. Thank you. We have more. Councilman Kelly, are you completed? No problem. Councilman Fonzie.
So, Chief, can you educate me, when someone gets a CCW permit, does it show up on their driver's license, or is there some way that you know in law enforcement that they may be carrying one in their car with them, or there's something that you learn from that?
So we'll keep a local record of who has CCW permits issued, and it is something that we can run through our local system. It does not come up on their driver's license, but we will have a hit if I run somebody's name. The person who has a CCW is required to carry that license with them at all times and when they're carrying their concealed weapon, and it is something that we would ask them to present to us so that we know who you're dealing with, and we know you're a good guy, not a bad guy necessarily.
Okay, thank you.
And also, go ahead, Councilman.
One more question. You might comment on some of the restrictions about the use of alcohol and what have you, while you have the concealed weapons permit, and some of the other restrictions you have when you might get it revoked real easy.
That was my question, too. Exactly. And, yeah, there are, for example, alcohol is a good one that you actually give up your right at that point. If you're intoxicated, you need to set that aside, I understand. Yeah. Could you go over any of those other kind of restrictions?
There are a number of them, and that's part of why we produce the thick handbook that we produced, because it has a lot of information in there about those types of restrictions, alcohol being the largest one. The one that's best for me, though, is that the individuals with the CCW are required to report to us if they have any kind of conviction. for criminal offenses, and we would be able to use that information to determine whether somebody should keep a CCW or not. For instance, you know, we've done whatever we were supposed to do and issued somebody a CCW permit, and we find out later that they were responsible for, you know, robbing somebody or, you know, committing some sort of felony act. We would certainly be able to revoke that CCW and, again, keep the weapon and the concealed weapon permit out of the hands of somebody who shouldn't have it. Domestic violence, things like battery, for instance, now individuals are not allowed to keep firearms. They've been charged with certain criminal offenses, and so those are the important ones to us. And then there's a host of others we could go over.
Well, thank you. And I think, as Councilman Kelly says, it is a serious area. That's where I think we trust your judgment and want you to exercise that judgment as you see fit. Any other council questions? We'll open up to the public. Any member of the public wishing to speak, feel free to come forward now. Welcome.
Thank you. My name's Edmund Temple. I'm a resident of Tascadero. Just one question. Could you give examples of the good cause or the just cause?
Speak a little to the mic.
Would you give an example of a just cause? We're hearing all the negatives here, which were interesting, but what basis would justify your issuing a permit?
And go ahead. Is that your only question?
That's my only question.
Okay. Thank you. We'll close public comment and bring it back to the chief and go ahead. I had asked this question of the chief earlier in the day.
Yes, you did. Really, it is a difficult question to answer. What we would be looking for, and what I believe is the practice that has, you know, most commonly been upheld by the courts, is something that is beyond just normal, hey, I don't feel safe. We want to see that somebody has a reason why they might be more specifically targeted than others, potentially. Say, for instance, they carry large amounts of cash, or they're a jeweler and they're carrying jewelry to and from. Doctors who carry prescription medications that somebody might want. There might be individuals who, because of the nature of their work or the nature of where they work, are more susceptible to being victimized or you know, have a potential for violence because of that. There could be any number of reasons. Really what we want to do is look at those reasons and say, okay, is there a justification behind it that is more than just the average citizen who says, yeah, I was walking to the grocery store the other day and I just kind of generally felt unsafe. Well, that's, for us, that's not good enough. We want to see something that would be over and above what the average citizen would encounter in the routine course of their day. And so it's difficult to answer. I appreciate the question because it is something that, you know, will ultimately be on my desk and I'll be weighing those options. Again, as long as we can show that there is some nexus between the safety of the individual and the cause that is something just above general, everyday, I don't feel safe.
Thank you. And a couple other question and a comment. Also, if you issue a CCW or if any police chief does in the state of California, is that permit then valid throughout the state of California? I know it's not valid outside of the California.
There is an actual... Chief Stone and I were talking about this just last week, but there is a movement to make CCW permits valid throughout the nation. If they're issued in one state, they would be valid anywhere in the other 49 states. So that is something that's being handled at the federal level and being pushed through. Remains to be seen what happens there, but the reality is right now it's a patchwork quilt, the United States is, of where you can carry and where you can't. And as you drive from one state to the next, you have to stop at the state line, unconceal your weapon, unload it, lock it in the trunk, drive through that state. And when you get to the next state, you can reload it, conceal it on your person, and continue driving. That's as it currently exists now.
However, though, it is the case that if it's issued in by one jurisdiction in the state, it's valid throughout the state.
That is correct.
Throughout the state. Okay, thank you. And I think we are done with deliberation, and I want to echo what chokes me up here, what Councilman Kelly said. It's something that we do take serious. We've certainly had a lot of questions because, you know, there are two sides. There, in our community, we have folks that look at weapons in general from different perspectives. So we're trying to weigh that out, have this discussion. I think when all is said and done, we trust you to, you know, safety is number one for our community. But I also think you're fair in your view of this. There are some chiefs that have taken a stance that blanketly, nope, not going to do concealed weapon permits. You, I think, are giving a person a benefit of the doubt that you go through the process. I feel like they get a fair hearing with you, and you'll make a determination. And I don't know that we have much to add to that, but I would suggest, Councilman Kelly, it might be appropriate for you to make a motion when you're ready.
I think this is just a file, receive and file. So.
Oh, well, then we don't.
I think we're ready to receive it and file it. Thank you.
And I really am just looking for kind of general consensus from council that the psychological testing is a good idea, and I haven't heard anything from council tonight that would steer me off of that course. So thank you.
I still think that you would exercise the option. There could be a case where you might know somebody and you would have the right to waive it if you so desired.
Yeah, it is optional. Right. More than likely, okay. We try not to show favoritism. We would try and be non-discretionary as much as possible through that process.
So, Councilman Fonzie, are you comfortable with that conclusion?
I am because you know the psychologist. If you didn't, I probably wouldn't feel that way. But if you feel comfortable and value his judgment, I will go with it.
I value her judgment very much.
Thank you.
Even better. Very good. It is a receive and file. Thank you. We'll move on to next item on the agenda is council announcements and reports. And we also have committee reports. I usually like to be picky and kind of divide them up, but for the sake of time, I'll just go from my left to my right. Anything you'd like to comment on, feel free.
Yes, on March the 13th, this Friday, there's going to be an affordable housing lecture down at the SLO Library, and some gentleman's going to show or demonstrate how to put some of the financing together for affordable housing projects. I hope to attend that. On March the 19th, the South Street apartment groundbreaking ceremony will take place. It's a 42-unit affordable housing project. I'm going to try to attend that one too and maybe make some connections with the people that have put the programs together because it's a whole different deal with the financing, and I hope to burn back some information to our staff and help to get some of these affordable housing projects under construction. I think we're running into actually an affordable housing crisis in the city, having dealt in real estate. You know, there's nothing out there that's really, really affordable. So hopefully this will work. The other update is, I think, I don't know, Luke, if you can bring up any of the statue stuff. The Charles Paddock statue, the clay part of the statue has been completed. I went up to the foundry last week. There it is. And Mark Greenway has just done a fantastic job. And it really does look like Charles Paddock. If you knew him, there was one picture that didn't get put up here of his head. But it's coming right along, and we're hoping to have it completed so the 4th of July we'll have the unveiling of it. So you can see on the bottom there if you'd like to make a donation or what have you, or you can contact me. They certainly would be appreciated.
Thank you.
I wanted to announce that on Sunday, March 22nd, Lighthouse will be having the reality tour. It is 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It's about a 3-hour event. It'll be at the Colony Park Community Center. One of the statistics they have is that teens who learn about prescription drug abuse from their parents are 42% less likely to abuse drugs. So what this reality tour does is there's actually a tour, so you're in groups, and there's an actual arrest and a jail experience, as well as an overdose scene and a funeral scene. And so those attending with their parents kind of see this, and it's narrated from someone, and you're hearing this young person's voice, and sort of the message is, I'm just like you, right? So it's very powerful. Each attendee also listens to someone who shares their addiction story and has recovered from that. There is also some talking to parents and kids together about how to talk about this, how to have that conversation. And so it's a really an excellent event. You can find them on Facebook, Lighthouse Atascadero. Google, you'll find them. The cost is only $5. And if you can't afford the $5, there are scholarship opportunities. So don't let that stand in your way. Excellent program, and I highly recommend the tour.
Thank you, Councilwoman Fonzi.
Very good. Just wanted to update you that there will be a position coming open on the Water Resources Advisory Committee, the RAC, and I'm hoping that I can get on that to represent you as your water issue liaison. Hopefully that will be coming back to the council fairly soon.
Thank you. And that has come up, and again, I think, as I've suggested before, having a kind of a council liaison by categories, we have already accepted Councilwoman Fonzi taking that role. I think this would be a good example of something that would be appropriate for her to take the lead on. I know Pass Robles has a council member on that. We'll have a staff person from a technical standpoint being involved, but having a council person too. So that will come back for discussion. My recommendation will be to continue on with Councilwoman Fonzi as the water liaison. Thank you.
Cool. On Friday, March 20th, Marsha Torgerson and myself are going to head down to Santa Maria to for the League of California Cities Channel County's dinner. So we'll get together with the group, all of our fellow council members and mayors from in our division, and Kacho Shajin is going to be the guest speaker. So any interesting information I'll bring back, and I'll share with you when we come back.
Thank you. Well, we do have a lot of things this council is involved in outside of this meeting. And again, I thank all of you for doing your part. Bob's involved with the housing, Heather with a lot of the youth activities, I think, are especially good. We've got, and we're really glad you're going to the league meeting because we want to be represented, but we just weren't all that able to make it this time. We've got a couple other extracurricular things going on, and we'll have an Integrated Waste Management Authority meeting tomorrow as chair, and we are meeting out at the Cold Canyon landfill, kind of an orientation for folks that are new board members, and again, the biggest thing continuing to be a topic is food waste recycling. We are making headway. Also, I think it was a benefit to law enforcement. It was a problem with the medical waste that was and pills, etc., being dropped off at police stations. We found an alternative for that countywide, and it's kind of removed that from the police stations. And I think that is just a better fit. So we are running it through pharmacies and working with the community that handles medication. So it's one less thing for law enforcement to have to deal with. We are making progress with our own bicycle committee. They've had their meeting now a time or two, and we're going to continue on. So I do think we're going to get a report back on that. And we are going to be working together on a bicycle event that will really be a North County event. Many of us participated in our Cycle de Mayo event. It may even be called the same thing, but again, we're focusing on Templeton with Atascadero and Paso heading that way. And last, of course, we have a number of folks involved with RISE, which used to be the North County Women's Resource Center. We're going to be putting on an event really co-hosted by Mayor Martin from Pass Robles, myself, and Debbie Arnold. And I know many of you are going to be involved with a Mother's Day picnic and brunch. There'll be a fundraiser for RISE coming up. So any other staff announcements? Did you have another thing to add?
I didn't realize that we were doing council members' reports with the
committee
reports.
Yeah, went ahead. Reports, any, yeah, so go ahead. We'll cycle back down and go ahead.
Okay, did you, Bob? I just want to say we decided at strategic planning to appoint a liaison for the tourism, and so I did attend the TBID meeting about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, and I think they were very pleased that we had talked about the need for communication, and you know, there we were that next meeting and implementing that. So I think they were pleased, and obviously you know based on what was on the agenda tonight, what they had decided. So I think this will be good going forward and keep that communication open, and I'll be bringing things back to all of you. Went to the EVC 2 weeks ago as well, and Rochelle presented for the City of Atascadero, and the EVC, I mean, the questions people were asking, they had no idea what was going on here in Atascadero. And Mike Manchek, who is the president and CEO of the EVC, just in email and voicemail was saying, you know, we had no idea about this business-friendly environment that you've created. We didn't know what was going on in Atascadero. We're so impressed with your policies and what's going on. It was so important for us to hear that. And Rochelle, you did a fantastic job. I mean, you just really laid out everything. And I think sometimes we just get used to it. Yeah, that's what we're doing, dormant perm. Oh, yeah, we extend. And for them to hear it was really wonderful for them to see what's going on here in Atascadero. So we were well represented. You did a great job. And it says that we're really moving in the right direction.
Yes, I have heard some feedback from that, too. So good job, Rochelle. Any other council or staff? Then we are adjourned. Thank you.